I've been carrying out a full security check on these think tank people.
Anything interesting?
Well, not really. They seem to be an exemplary lot. Just one oddity. Quite a few of them were members of something called the Scientific Reform Society.
Oh, really? And who might they be?
Oh, a little tinpot organization founded years ago. It wants to reform the world on rational and scientific lines. You know the sort of thing. Harmless bunch of cranks, if you ask me. But recently...
Yes? Go on, then.
Well, they've had a sudden rush of new members. Quite a few well-known scientists. Younger people, too. Computer technicians and so on.
Is Miss Winters a member?
Apparently. Angelico, too, and quite a few of the think tank lot.
Doesn't sound their style, does it?
No.
Oh, well.
Where are you off to?
Home to bed. Busy day tomorrow. Still a working girl, you know.
Yes, quite right, too. You leave all this business to us.
One thing about reform societies, they're never adverse to a bit of free publicity.
Doctor, what are we going to do? Or shall we leave it all to Miss Smith?
Let's pay a visit to Think Tank tomorrow, Brigadier.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 20 past five. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 26th of July, 2024. Apologies for the delay in starting. A few techie problems as we have setting up each week now in this studio, Eastone Studios, from which we're streaming live in Bristol, which with London's Inner Temple is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqeuk.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex. Also, one of the easiest places to pick us up, do download it. The best thing to do, by the way, is just delete it and then re-upload it from either of any of the Play Stores or Apple Store, which is Not the BCFM Politics Show app. With my new phone, after my previous phone just stopped, I had to reset the phone every time I'd had a phone call because the phone calls just carried on and I couldn't turn them off. Tried everything possible, you know, wasted hours and hours playing with the damn thing, but it still wouldn't finish the phone calls. Anyway, so I had to get a new phone. That's very, very clever the way they chase you onto all this new technology. But that's where you get it. It's Aurora, please, not Google Play. If you can get that, and then you can disable Google Play and download everything from Aurora. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. I'm talking here about people like Crispin Hunt. Is it Crispin Hunt? Oh, gosh. Anyway, whatever his name was, the Tory MP who said that government ministers might be arrested for war crimes if they helped the genocide in Gaza. And then literally the next week, he's arrested himself for alleged... child abuse and rape. So, and then he's released with no charge, but he's stopped from being a Tory MP. So anyway, he was a MP from Reigate in Surrey, by the way. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies, crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and witch queen Camilla wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS through their latest glove puppet with look what crawled out of the recycling bin, Panda-eyed energy saboteur Secretary Ed Miliband. Anyway, helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF's Fourth Reich Matrix. And the Irish is this week is Dr. Judith Brown. No Martin this week because we had trouble getting Skype going, which is one of the reasons why we're so late starting. Did have a go at getting Skype and Martin on there, but just can't do it, I'm afraid, at the moment. So we're going to be looking this week mainly at the climate issue as Judith has been doing a course on climate, but obviously there's other things going on too, quite a lot. In fact, I've got David Halpin here talking this week about the King and why he thinks he may actually not have cancer from his own diagnosis. He doesn't think he looks like he's got cancer. To me, he says no. So that's one thing. But also, we've got the amazing programme, which was repeated. Actually, I didn't realise it had been on 2 years ago. No one tells me these things. It was on Sky Arts. A programme called Accelerate or Die, a documentary. And we'll be having a clip from that also later on, as well as Whitney Webb talking about the control of, by the Bilderbergers. Great to hear her going on about the Bilderbergs, of the techno revolution and surveillance state by these two sponsors of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. That is Eric Schmidt from Google and Peter Thiel from PayPal, but both from Bilderberg. Anyway, welcome, Judith. Nice to have you back.
Thank you for inviting me, Tony.
So you have been doing this course. Do you want to just, because I think that's the last time we saw you, you were saying you were thinking about doing this course. You've now actually been through it. Whereabouts is the course and what was it?
Well, it was an internet course by run by an American scientist, and he involved other scientists in the course as well.
Yeah, who is he?
His name's David Siegel.
Well, because I did contact him.
Yes.
Didn't get any reply.
Yeah.
A couple of times.
I did ask him if he would talk on your radio. But anyway, I think he's quite busy at the moment.
Is he Bristol University?
No, he's in America.
He's in the States. So where was this course run
from?
It was
an internet course. And it was, the main reason I did the course, as you know, I've been looking at censorship for many, many years and fact-check groups over the last couple of years. And I wanted to do some fact-checking on the climate. I used to be very sort of taken in by the climate narrative, but I'd read one or two books that had made me question it, and I really wanted to do a course so that I had a grounding of basic knowledge myself, obviously, in 12 weeks.
Well, you've said on your Substack it's some of the most difficult science you've ever done.
Yeah, it is. First of all, the first couple of weeks, my head was just shaking, and it was very difficult. But eventually, I made sort of like quite a lot of sense of it. We covered everything from paleoclimatology in the past, going on to the things that affect the climate, many sort of like natural things that affect the climate.
Paleoclimatology, I mean, we were told, weren't we, certainly when we were at school, and I don't know, you know, you kind of believe things when you're kids, when you're told them by teachers, you don't know any better, was that a great big comet or something hit the Earth, and that's why the dinosaurs were made extinct. Do they talk about anything like that? I mean, obviously, that was a big change in the climate.
Yeah, that wasn't on my climate course.
No, they didn't mention that one, though.
Yeah, they didn't mention that.
Mainstream, they don't know, really, do they? Things like the Ice Age, they do know, because we see the evidence of the glaciers and everything in our mountains and things.
And in fact, they do have lots of ways of collecting knowledge. Like, for example, trees use carbon dioxide, and depending on how much carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere, they have a little holes on the underside of their leaves. So if there's not much carbon dioxide, they have a lot of holes. And if there's a lot of carbon dioxide, they don't have many. So they can look at sort of fossils of different ages and sort of like work out how much carbon dioxide there was around at that particular time. And so they've got lots of sort of like ways that they try to sort of like solve the climate issue.
I'm sure, but there's other things. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here, really. If, say, for example, the Ice Age, massive difference. I mean, that it makes it impossible for trees to grow and things like that in vast areas of the world. Yeah. And so that is probably the equivalent of wiping out like at least a third, maybe more, of the world's rainforest, isn't it?
Well,
when something like that happens, it's a disaster for the climate, surely.
Yeah, well, Tony, we're still in an ice age now, because as long as there's ice at the poles, we're actually in an ice age. So we're coming out of an ice age at the moment, but we are actually in an ice age at the moment, because if there's ice at the poles, we are actually still in an ice age.
Even when
obviously
warming, it's warming. And we've just heard this week it's the warmest ever this week. I think it's. I've got a clip in a minute from the UN Secretary General talking about that.
Well, it wasn't that warm in Bristol, was it? But
no,
however,
it's been quite chilly.
It has,
in Britain.
Yeah, but obviously there's a difference between weather where you have single events like how hot it is on any particular time, climate, which is the weather over a long period of time, at least 30 years, and then also the environment, which a lot of people sort of see things in the environment like pollution, for example, and animals are some animals are becoming extinct or moving away from certain areas, but so they link that environment, those environmental issues, with climate, but they're not necessarily linked. And climate are obviously the environment is affected by the climate, but they're not necessarily the same thing.
There's another thing, is people love fussing about the weather, don't they?
The British
particularly. They seem to love going on. The Daily Express is probably the worst of all the newspapers. All the time they're going, oh, this is about to happen, isn't it terrible? Actually, at the end of the day, if you talk to people that study this, ecologists, many of them will say, well, look, this, the weather just goes up and down. That's just what it
absolutely
does.
Absolutely. The weather changes. I think that, they talk about climate change now, but the climate has always changed. You know, looking at this paleoclimatology, there are changes all the time, and so we're in a point of change now. We always have been.
Well, what was the hot summer of 1976? You can remember that. That caused by man-made pollution?
Well, they didn't mention that at the time. I was expecting twins at the time.
Well, it might have caused it, but they didn't.
So I do remember it particularly well.
In fact, our local green, which was right next to where I was being brought up at the time, all the grass died. It all went green. It didn't quite die. It did come back, but it all went grey. Yeah. Everyone was kind of sad. What's happened to the poor old grass? But then next year it all came back. That was a blip.
Yeah.
But climate change apparently didn't exist back then.
No. In fact, I think that the worry at the time in the 1970s was that we were heading into a sort of a cooling period. So people were thinking that we were cooling down in spite of the hot weather in the 1970s. So I think the fashions change.
I love the 70s. Yeah. I love the 70s. It was just a great decade, great music
indeed,
and all sorts going on. The other, Jack Hargreaves was on the TV in the 1970s with his programme Out of Town. And on this show, I've interviewed his nephew, Simon Baddeley, who does a brilliant job online in keeping Jack Hargreaves' legacy going. He makes sure that all of his films are available on DVD and things like that for people to buy, because they really preserved a lot of the things in the countryside that after the Second World War were starting to die off with mechanisation. And one of the programmes here, and I will put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, shows you in the 1970s, one year which was unbelievably terrible floods. The whole of, he lived in Hampshire, where all the rivers were flooded. You couldn't get from one place. It's a bit like when the Somerset Levels flooded, and the weather was absolutely terrible all year. The farmers' productivity was virtually zero. And then the next year, this was one in the 70s sometime, the next year it was so hot hardly anything grew again, sort of like the total opposite. But again, these things have happened. If that was to happen now, it's obvious there'd have to be instant action by Extinction Rebellion to close the world down until we came up with climate policies.
I agree.
Back onto your oh, let's have a listen to Gutierrez, because this is something that he's brought up this week. It'd be great to hear what you've got to say about the UN Secretary General, because the UN are very, very big on climate, aren't they? Here he is this week talking about extreme heat.
It's summertime, but the living is no longer easy. This has been a week of unprecedented heat. In other words, this past Sunday, Monday and Tuesday were the three hottest days on record. But let's face facts. Extreme temperatures are no longer a one day, one week or one month phenomenon. If there is one thing that unites our divided world, is that we are all increasingly feeling the heat. The message is clear. The heat is on. Extreme heat is having an extreme impact on people and planet. The world must rise to the challenge of rising temperatures, and I thank you. Today, our focus is on the impact of extreme heat. But let's not forget that there are many other devastating symptoms of the climate crisis. Ever more fierce hurricanes, floods, droughts, wildfires, rising sea levels, and the list goes on. To tackle all these symptoms, we need to fight the disease. And the disease is the madness of incinerating our only home. The disease is the addiction to fossil fuels. The disease is climate inaction. And leaders across the board must wake up and step up. And that means government. Extreme heat amplifies inequality, inflames food insecurity, and pushes people further into poverty. And so we must respond by massively increasing access to low-carbon cooling, expanding passive cooling, such as natural solutions and urban design, and cleaning up cooling technologies while boosting their efficiency.
So there's Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, weighing in on the climate issue. I mean, just to begin with, he really gets my back up, Judith, because he's there going on about poverty and inequality. Well, if you were to ask a poor person what would be the best thing for you, they would almost certainly, very, very low down the list, would be sort out the climate challenge. It would be, you know, I need money for food, or I need land to grow food, I need some space for a workshop to make a living. These are the sorts of things people need. So he's saying that the climate is actually inextricably linked to inequality and poverty.
I think that the changes that are taking place now, which some people call green colonisation, actually are throwing a lot of people off their land. For example, the carbon credits that are being sold. For, you get a country, I'll use the example of the United Arab Emirates. It's no worse nor better than anyone else. But what it doesn't do is change its use of fossil fuels. But what it does do is buy up huge sections of Africa. Apparently the land that it's bought up in Africa is bigger than the whole of the British Isles. And on that land, it then plants trees. But what it does is throws the indigenous people off the land. They actually advertise for rangers that are qualified in martial arts. They employ sort of people who are called carbon hunters, who assess how much carbon has actually been saved by these trees, by the planting of them and by the growing of the trees, and people are sort of thrown off the land. Similarly, I know that people think of deserts as wasteland, but deserts are not wasteland. They have desert animals in there and also oasis farmers. They're actually throwing the oasis farmers off the land, and they're getting rid of animals because you can't have desert, you know, rats or animals that might chew the cables for the solar heating. And so these poor people are being taken, their homes are being taken away from them. And of course, then you've got a situation where ever since the sort of carbon credit scheme has been starting, Migration Watch has shown that there's been increasing number of illegal migrants, both into Europe and into North America, and Migration Watch directly linked this to the green colonization, where people are thrown off the land in order to grow trees. So trees being more important than people.
You sent me as part of my homework this film, I think, called The Privatization of Nature.
Yes.
It's a documentary. I thoroughly recommend everyone to watch it. It's actually one of the most powerful things I've seen for a long time. It's exactly the sort of thing that the mainstream press should be doing, but they're not doing.
Yeah.
I mean, the countless billions that are spent on people like Sky, BBC, ITV, they're not interested in making films like that. Was that part of your course? Were you doing that as part of the course?
The course just talked about climate, but because I was looking at censorship and what has been censored, I sort of just did a lot of research and found things that that people should know. And one of the films that I found was this privatization of nature. What they've got is sort of like mitigation banks, and if a sort of company wants to expand it into a geographic area that may be sensitive, what they do is they go to a mitigation bank, and then they pay an amount of money for saving an area of land or an endangered animal, and then they're allowed to move into the area where they want to move. So in other words, the rich are paying to do what they want to, whereas other people are just their needs are just not considered at all.
Now, the Wall Street and the City of London banks, plus obviously people like the Frankfurt banks, the Euro, in the Western world, seem to have adopted this new approach, which is invest in this climate stuff. We're going to save the planet, but actually, what's happening on the ground is speculators are buying up land that indigenous people need to live on.
Yeah, and not only buying up land, but also buying all natural assets, and then they just create them, and they say, the life of this particular snake is worth however many thousand pounds or however many million pounds or however many billion pounds, and then somebody pays to save that endangered snake, and because of that they can expand their business into an area that they're that previously was not there. So it's and the other thing in terms of the banking system, Tony, that certainly the New York Stock Exchange thinks that this asset class is too risky, and they're not taking part of it. But as you saw in the film, the privatization of nature, what they're saying is the way that they're bundling up these assets and selling them off to speculators, pension funds, and people like this hedge funds, it's exactly the same as the subprime market, subprime housing market, and the subprime housing market collapsed. And carbon, which is, there's so much debate concerning whether carbon is anything to do with climate.
In a way, you see, there's more debates here, aren't there? Yeah. So we've got a debate about, is this climate change really man-made? So that's a whole question in itself. And then there's a whole nother discussion to have around whether this whole idea of zero carbon, stopping all use of fossil fuels, is going to help things. And then in a way, there's another debate, which is, what's the point of us doing it if China is just carrying on using fossil fuels and burning coal willy-nilly? Because it's not as if there's a sort of invisible wall up where China's atmosphere doesn't just swirl around the world with everyone else's.
Well, of course, Tony, they're talking about China, whereas at the same time they're all doing it themselves. So they're blaming China, whereas we're carrying on using fossil fuels ourselves and buying these carbon credits, which is, it's like sort of the pot calling the kettle black. But when you look at it, we're not decreasing our carbon use. But I think the other thing is relating to carbon. I think there's actually very little scientific evidence that really, really points to carbon as the driver of carbon.
We're talking about CO2, aren't we?
CO2, yeah.
Yeah, so not other forms of carbon, no, just CO2.
There's very little evidence of it being a sort of a driving factor in climate change. The difficulty in the academic world, just like on many other topics, the academic world has been captured completely. So if people want to advance their career, they have to say that climate change is real. If they do a report into why chipmunks aren't are hibernating for longer, for example, then they'll sort of say, well, it isn't anything to do with climate change, or we couldn't find anything to do with climate change, but this needs more study. So all sorts of subjects are getting linked into climate change.
Well, look, I suppose a lot of people will be saying, well, look, if the UN Secretary General is talking about this stuff, then it must be true.
I think that probably I would say exactly the opposite. If the UN Secretary General is talking about it, it probably isn't true.
Why not?
Yeah, because
why are you so cynical about the UN? The UN is the only thing we've got, really, isn't it? For things like the Gaza situation and Ukraine.
Yeah, actually,
all that.
There are some things that they've been quite good on, and certainly the IC. Jay this last week has made a very good statement and on Gaza, but on Palestine, not just Gaza. So there are some things that they've done that are good, but overall, I think that the difficulty is that the rich and powerful tend to follow the same agenda. You may get somebody at the UN, say at UNRWA, making some special rapporteur for Palestine making good statements, but the UN doesn't follow through on action. You know, the UN Security Council has never done anything to support the Palestinians.
Well, hang on, they did do a vote on the ceasefire eventually, didn't they? Even though, of course, there wasn't a ceasefire.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, at least there's UN pressure on these companies. Countries, but sometimes you do think that it's more to do with corporations than it is to do with nation states, especially since the nation states are virtually bankrupt. But anyway, look, this whole idea of shifting a lot of economics and getting people to invest in these nature-friendly speculative investments. Let's have a listen now to a clip from that documentary you sent me, The Privatisation of Nature, which I'll put a link up to. In fact, what I'll do is I'll put the full audio of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and a link up to it, because it really is. It reminded me a bit watching it of when I saw Planet of the Humans, the Michael Moore film. Jeff, I can't remember his second name, actually made the film, but in cooperation with Michael Moore. And The Planet of the Humans shows you absolutely clearly what they're doing. Is they're saying, well, it's okay to cut an entire forest down and feed it into, because it's a replacement for fossil fuels. So wood is okay to burn. These are like wood chips, basically. You just get a forest, shred it, and feed it into the power station. And we're doing this right now in Drax. By the way, Drax power station up I think it's in the northeast somewhere near, just north of it. I actually went there. I can't even remember. It was near Doncaster. Selby, that's right. And I tried to go. I went in there, I phoned them up, and I booked to go on a tour. They didn't get back to me, but I turned up, and they have the most incredible security. Unbelievable. This is just at Drax Power Station, which was a coal-fired power station. And I don't know whether they think there's going to be a terrorist attack there, or whether Extinction Rebellion are going to do it. Well, I wouldn't have thought Extinction Rebellion would do, because they're doing what Extinction Rebellion wants, because they've got rid of all the coal. It was one of the biggest coal-fired power stations in the world. And not only were they extremely rude to me when I turned up for the tour, told me to go and sit, just go home, you know. Hang on a minute, I've turned up for the tour, there's the email. They then, when I did leave, they followed me to the car and made sure that I got in my car, and I started recording them as they're following, and then they turned around and went back to their little security place. So they were, I would say, paranoid, like fascists or something.
Absolutely.
At Drax Power Station when I went to try and inquire into this. But anyway, look, let's get back to this documentary. So it's called The Privatisation of Nature, and here's a little extract of what's happening with some of these new investments.
These systems I'm talking about starting to use our trees, our forests, especially in the global south, in developing countries, in the backyard of indigenous peoples who are brothers and sisters, to use it as far as this big carbon market scheme.
How should land be used to live on and grow food, or to replant trees? In order to protect the forests in various locations in Africa, the villagers have been expelled and their homes burnt to the ground. In Honduras, dozens of farmers have already died protesting against these sorts of expulsions. How can trees be worth more than people?
Our people are literally dying. We are dying. It is a form of genocide. It is a form of genocide against our people.
But for now, nothing can stop the charge of the raging bull of Wall Street. It has barely a second thought for who it tramples underfoot when it finds new sectors in which to make money.
they use speculation as if it were a bad word, right? I don't necessarily see speculation as always a bad thing. And basically, what speculation is people taking risks. And hopefully, the people who are taking the risks can assume the risks if they don't pan out. Already, we've seen millions of dollars being invested in projects that protect forests. Why? Because people are hoping that they will be able to make money selling carbon credits in the future. They're not making money now. Most of them are not making money now. They're speculating.
Yes, that's a very moving part of the film, Tony. Thank you for sharing.
Privatisation of nature, new environmental markets. So there are other ways of doing these things, aren't they? And one of the things, one of the most brilliant parts of that film was where they explained that the governments for decades have been trying to regulate some of these big corporations who are making a mess of the planet in all sorts of different ways, not just through coal-fired power stations, but largely through devastation of habitats. And the corporations are so powerful that they've successfully lobbied to stop the governments regulating them. But they've realised that they've got a bit of an image problem. And so the best thing to do is to set up markets where they can do what they want, but they just pay somebody else. And in this case, we're talking here about paying somebody to burn down villages in another part of the world to create space where someone can grow trees. And so when that corporation, say here in Britain or in the United States, does its dirty work, in other words, maybe it's got a factory that's polluting here, that it can pay the company to plant trees where these people used to live.
Absolutely. But, Tony, this particular thing isn't even new, because the eugenics movement was closely linked with the Green Movement, particularly through the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers started a green NGO, I think, called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in the early part of the last century. And that also, they think that tens of millions of people were driven off their land because they wanted a conservation project on that area. So it isn't new. It's just the same as except that the trees that they're planting now, I think that what they were doing in the past was that they were preserving areas that were already there, but the trees that they're planting now aren't necessarily good replacements. Like, for example, there's a mining company in the Amazon that's mining for iron, and they have already planted, I think, 100,000 acres of trees, and they're planning to plant another 400 acres of trees to replace the forest that they're taking down. But what they're planting is eucalyptus trees, and those eucalyptus trees will be reaped, if you like, in 30 years' time in order to provide biomass, and then presumably they'll plant some more at that point. So, but of course, if you look at the rainforests themselves, the quality of the diversity and the soil and everything else in the rainforest is completely different to the monoculture eucalyptus trees. So, but the difficulty is that some people actually think that when they're going on holiday, they buy a few carbon credits in order to offset their holiday, and they don't realise that it's going into these schemes that are throwing people off the land and increasing the migration flow to countries in the West that are in effect benefiting from growing these carbon offset areas.
Well, look, one test case is the last new mine in the whole of Britain in West Cumbria, which has also been in the news this week. News and Star, the Cumberland News, although Cumberland doesn't exist anymore, doesn't it? This is Cumbria now. But anyway, they still call themselves the Cumberland News. They are saying that the West Cumbria Mining has robustly defended the legal challenges against their mine. The company behind a proposed new coal mine near Whitehaven says it has robustly defended legal challenges heard in the High Court this week. The three-day hearing examined legal challenges by Friends of the Earth and South Lakes Action on Climate Change, SLACC. Oh, South Lakes Action on Climate Change, which I think is like basically just one person. But I don't know where they get all this money from to do these challenges. But anyway, you know, that's their right to do it if they do manage to get some money from George Soros or whoever it happens to be. So the three-day hearing, the decision is argued that the decision which was approved under the last government by Michael Gove was unlawful in 2022. On July the 10th, less than a week before the hearing was due to take place, the rebranded Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government, now run by Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner, confirmed it was dropping its defence of the Whitehaven coal mine. So it's saying that, that Friends of the Earth will be allowed to, or they won't actually be defending it. Well, West Cumbria Mining has said, well, actually, okay, if the government doesn't want to do it, we will defend it instead, because we've got all the arguments ourselves. So their basic argument, well, I think maybe it's best if we have a listen to, cause I think these sorts of things are important to understand what's going on. The mining, you know, obviously is a very important part of an industrial economy.
Yeah.
And it looks as if somehow, rather than just saying, right, Britain is no longer allowed to be an industrial economy, someone somewhere said, well, you kind of can be, but we want you using nuclear. So, I mean, what would you say to anyone that's saying, well, actually, nuclear is much better, you know, new technology. Let's just get rid of all these fossil fuels.
Yeah.
We can use that instead.
Yes, some people in the green movement do actually think that nuclear, in the end, is less damaging. I haven't. It isn't something that I've looked at myself, Tony. So I'm at the moment. I'm sitting that out. I don't have a position.
One thing that strikes me is, you know, we were talking about the 1970s earlier. Two big campaigns were the support for the miners in the miners' strike, and also of course CND, which was not only was it against the nuclear weapons, it was also against low level radiation coming out of these nuclear power stations,
yes,
and
yeah.
The fact that the radioactive waste is so damaging. Anyway, let's have a listen now to an ITV report on this Whitehaven coal mine court case, which explains much better than I can do the ins and outs of who is actually taking this case. Now the government and Angela Rayner and Ed Miliband have decided to just step away and let Friends of the Earth win it.
A High Court hearing of two legal challenges against plans for a new coal mine in Whitehaven has concluded.
Over 3 days, the court heard from environmental campaigners opposed to the scheme and the company behind it, who say the colliery would create hundreds of new jobs.
Kieran McFadgen has been in court for us. He sent us this report.
Well, it's been another gruelling day in the High Court as lawyers debated whether or not Michael Gove's granting of planning permission for the Whitehaven coal mine in 2022 was lawful. Today, the developers' lawyers finished their argumentation and the campaigners had a chance to respond. Now, once again, the judge criticised both sides for unnecessarily muddling the case, but it still got finished at about lunchtime. Now, as the campaigners head for the train home, I've been taking a look back at what's happened over these last 3 days. The week started off with excitement, rallies and chants outside the Royal Courts of Justice. But typically for a case of this scale, this excitement soon dwindled when it came up against the grind of digging into deeply complicated law and policy over these 3 days in court. Last month, a campaigner from Surrey, Sarah Finch, won a Supreme Court case against planning permission for a new oil well. In this case, it was ruled that in applications like this, the emissions that result not just from extracting the fossil fuel, but from burning it as well, have to be considered. These burning emissions are called downstream emissions. Campaigners argue that since the environmental impact assessment for the mine didn't consider downstream emissions, it only recognised 1% of the impact the mine would have on the environment. Therefore, the decision to grant planning permission was unlawful.
Gosh, it's been so gruelling. It's been a really, really tiring 3 days. But to be honest, it's at the end of a fairly tiring 5 years. But we really felt we had to do it. We had to put the effort in because, you know, there are local harms. There are harms to Cumbria. There are harms to the whole globe.
Last week, the government announced that they would not be defending the previous government's decision to approve plans for the mine. The lawyers for the developers, West Cumbria Mining, however, did come to the mine's defence. Over 1.5 days, they primarily argued a principle called substitution, which means that if the coal is being dug up in Cumbria, it isn't being dug up somewhere else, And for example, if the same amount of coal was being extracted in, say, the US, then emissions would be higher because it would be transported further. They also argued Sarah Finch's case isn't relevant because the mine is overall net zero emissions, as globally emissions are decreasing, and that due to complexities in coal blends and types of furnace, trying to quantify potential emissions is all speculation on the part of the campaigners. West Cumbria Mining themselves have always been relatively silent. I approached them today and they declined to comment at this time. Their last public update was in April, when they said that they were focusing on preparing for construction. Perhaps what best signified the mood of the hearing was this group of quizzes from Kendal, who joined in silent prayer outside the court, as campaigners, West Cumbria Mining, and indeed the whole of West Cumbria, wait and hope that the judge finds in their favour. Well, when Sarah Finch's case was heard in the High Court in 2020, the judge's decision took about a month to come through, so many people are expecting this one to be on a similar timescale, but the judge himself did not commit to a time. If West Cumbria Mining win, then their granted application stands. If the campaigners win, then it goes back to the Secretary of State, who is now Angela Rayner, to make the decision. And of course, there's always appeals from either side on a point of law, which one lawyer described as possibly leading to a rerun of this case.
So Judith, that's all sorts of, this whole idea of substitution seems to be kind of key here. It's that, well, if you're not going to dig this stuff up here, someone else is going to have to dig it up, and then you're going to have to transport it across the world, which is going to be more bad for the environment.
Well, of course, this is a lot of the sort of irony. You know, we're buying carbon credits and buying in, planning to bring in solar energy and build huge from Morocco and build huge batteries. If we have these huge batteries, I mean, I don't know how big they'd have to be for the whole country, but you'd have to have lithium mines then.
Well, and this is so, one thing they say is we haven't solved the storage problem.
No.
So that, you know, you're thinking you can store electricity just like, coal. No, you can't.
No.
Sorry. No. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't work like that. And, I mean, certainly, for example, there's a UK-Morocco pipeline where they've got solar energy in Morocco in a desert. I think some of that desert belongs to the Western Sahara, which is occupied by Morocco. And political commentators think that what will happen is that Western Sahara occupation will be accepted and not challenged by Europe, seeing that a lot of Europe are buying energy from the Moroccan deserts. And that's planned to be coming into Devon on a 2,000-mile cable and then stored in these huge, huge batteries. Well, some people have called this a climate fantasy rather than a solution, because batteries of that size, they don't know how they're going to get the mineral components for it, so they don't see how it can work. And of course, when the energy is made in by the sunlight in Morocco, apart from the fact that the oasis farmers have been thrown off their land and maybe contributing to the migrants, it's also using up all of the water resources in Morocco, because when you've got a desert, you have to keep washing the panels, because solar panels in the desert get very dusty and they need constantly washing, so they have very high water usage. And then we're thinking that we are going to bring this into England. I mean, the story is that it's going to provide 7.5% of our energy needs. But when you think of sort of like down the line, the things that the harms that have come is, you see, I've tried to look for risk-benefit analysis, and I haven't found a risk-benefit analysis on different sorts
of
energy.
You know what? This all reminds me very much of the Iraq War.
Yeah.
It's like they decided they were going to go to war, and then they were kind of scrambling around looking for excuses to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not as if it's... It doesn't seem to have much intellectual rigour to it. In other words, you start to poke it and have a look. It's paper thin.
Yeah.
It's the idea is, this is what we're going to sell sell to the public. Yeah. But they better not question anything.
Yeah.
Because actually, we're just going to do it anyway. We don't care. Yeah. So rather like all the millions, and I don't know how much was ploughed into this whole idea of carbon capture, the coal industry was basically conned into saying, oh, well, if you can capture the CO2, which they could, from your coal-fired power stations, you can carry on and everything will be fine, except at the last minute they changed their mind and said you can't. All that money was wasted, which of course means that the coal, that they'd had to invest that into the future of coal mining, and it was all taken away from them. Anyway, look, I mentioned at the start, didn't I, the hottest week of the year ever, apparently, and the hottest few days anyway. And Professor Michael Grubb from University College London, he's a climate scientist there, and he had this to say about the world breaking the hottest day record for the second day in a row this week.
I can actually bring you up to date, Andrew. The Copernicus Climate Centre's data suggests that yesterday beat Sunday by a more significant margin. So
yesterday was the hottest day recorded on the planet.
This is the hottest day recorded on the planet, and almost certainly the hottest day in history and going back hundreds of thousands of years at least.
So how do you feel about this great movement around the Western world to say, actually, climate science is all bunk, we can relax, we don't need to think about net zero, we don't need to think about sustainable green energy or any of that, it's too expensive, it's too difficult, let's just get on with enjoying our lives?
Well, it's a bit bizarre to see some of that narrative, and I think there are obviously forces trying to maybe give it more prominence than it really has. I mean, actually, I know almost nobody, I see almost nothing now trying to dispute that climate change is happening. It's actually really straightforward. If you put out 40 billion tons of heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere every year, at least half of it is going to stay there for a century or more, the planet's going to get warmer. What else could happen? So that has always been very straightforward, very well known, and anyone who disputes that was basically disputing well-established basic science. What gets interesting, of course, the Earth is complicated. Scientists have complicated models to understand exactly what will happen. There will be what scientists would call both positive and negative feedbacks. There'll be more water vapor. Other things happen that may dampen or accelerate. What we've really seen is we're on track, only somewhat worse than it seems to have accelerated in the last few years.
So that's Professor Michael Grubb from University College London, finishing with the wonderful phrase, it seems to have accelerated within the last few months. Is it really, do you think, the most the hottest couple of days ever in the history of planet Earth?
First of all, there are lots of people who contest the figures because of the way that they're recorded now, which is completely
not according
different.
To him. No, he's saying that actually everyone agrees now.
No, well, it's very easy for them to agree because any scientists who don't agree don't get any research funding and get called climate deniers. And
you know
then
what?
They
you
have
and I,
to leave the
I've
industry.
Got an idea here. Yeah. Why don't you and I put in an application for we're looking into the climate effects on alcoholism.
Yeah.
Right, the effect of climate on the incidence of alcoholism. You will get funded to
absolutely.
Do that sort of. This is
absolutely.
The crazy world
yeah,
we live
exactly.
in. I mean, another story this week is to do with our universities and how they're failing because they're not getting enough foreign students in, and they're desperate for these foreign students now. They can't survive without them. So the universities are totally dependent on these sorts of research grants, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, and but I don't know. My grandson is studying maths at Imperial College, and on his course, 80% of the students are Chinese. So I think that some colleges are doing really well at getting foreign students.
Well, but maybe that's not enough to keep them going. This is a crazy thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, I think that in itself is very worrying because it means that maybe there's a lot of very talented mathematicians who are British who can't get into the top colleges to study mathematics, and maybe they have to choose a different subject, or maybe they have to go to a university that isn't so esteemed. So, in effect, it's got its problems. But I think that relating to the climate, certainly people are recording now temperatures in urban areas, whereas they always used to record them in rural areas. And if you record them in urban areas, you have a heat island effect, so the temperatures are much higher.
Well, we have fires.
I don't know whether that has happened, but you can actually, if you look at the temperatures that are taken in rural areas and compare them to the temperatures in urban areas, there is quite a significant difference.
Well, there was a terrific story last year, I think we had, because there were some fires broke out last summer, and they were saying, oh, it's really, really hot this year, it's unprecedented, blah, blah. Well, it turned out that it was an active RAF airfield, an RAF station, where the temperature had been recorded, and it had been recorded at a specific time, two specific times, just after two jets had taken off on the main runway.
Yeah.
So there's a massive wash from the back end of the engine to bring the temperature up to a certain point and then back down to a...
Yeah.
But, and they've taken the high points, you see? So you can't really trust a lot of the figures that you're getting. It's almost as if there is this, you know, a will for... climate to be a great big disaster.
Yeah.
In a similar way, there was a will for a war in 2003.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very difficult to defeat them. I think that the climate narrative has really sort of grabbed people, and I think that because people think that the fossil fuel industry is the only industry with a lot of money, in fact, the fossil fuel industry isn't doing anything to fund people who believe that the rise in temperature is due to natural causes, position of the sun coming out of the ice age, and other sort of natural factors, clouds, etc. And in fact, one of the things at the moment is that there's more moisture in the stratosphere because there was a huge volcano, the biggest volcano for 100 years, which was 150 metres under the sea. So all of the debris from the volcano went into the sea, and a huge amount of steam came out of the sea and went into the stratosphere. And when you have extra moisture in the stratosphere, it does raise its temperature. So that might be a reason. But of course, they haven't told anyone about the Hunkatunga volcano, because what they want people to think is that climate temperatures, where they're hotter, are due to natural causes. But it seems to me that it's not just the whole of Europe hasn't had really high temperatures this year. And it's quite interesting, because if you look at weather maps at the moment, as soon as the temperature goes up about 30, they start making the weather maps sort of like bright red, or, you know, orange and colours like this. Whereas in the past, they just put on a sort of like a little sticker saying 30 degrees. They didn't colour it red. So they're sort of like creating this impression. The other thing is that on the climate course that I was on, certainly the statistics that we were shown showed that the adverse weather events weren't increasing. There've always been droughts. There've always been wildfires,
hurricanes,
and hurricanes. Yeah, and they haven't. They're not increasing significantly. And certainly, the number of people worldwide that are dying in these adverse events is actually going down quite dramatically. Now, obviously, there's much sort of better medical care and rescue services, but the numbers are still going down really dramatically. If you compare them to, say, 50 years ago. So that indicates to me that that maybe the adverse events aren't as severe as they're making out.
It does, doesn't it? Comparing this to the Iraq War, I mean, I don't think it's a totally silly thing to do, because, you know, what you end up with, seems to me nowadays, is you get an elite decision made, you could even call it a fascist decision, really, by corporations, by wealth managers. We're going to do this. And then there's a whole load of money for the PR operation through politicians, through lobbies, through government, through media, through television, through radio, etc., to sell this idea to the public by going on and on and on about it. It looks to me as if a similar thing's going on with these new climate markets. But the point is, I suppose, if we say yes to when we said yes to the Iraq war, then there was all sorts of other horrid things happened just afterwards. So, you know, we got the Gaddafi overthrown in Libya. We got the invasion by ISIS of Syria. We got all sorts of things happening as a result of that.
The Yemen war.
And so the question is, with climate, what other things might be in the pipeline for us if we agree to this? So you sent me a fascinating little clip, which is to do with tracking people's every individual's carbon footprint. Let's have a listen to that now.
We're developing, through technology, an ability for consumers to measure their own carbon footprint. What does that mean? That's, where are they traveling? How are they traveling? What are they eating? What are they consuming on the platform? So, individual carbon footprint tracker. Stay tuned. We don't have it operational yet, but this is something that we're working on.
So there you go. There's one of the things. So everything you do will be tracked. You'll be under surveillance. Wherever you go, whatever you eat, whatever you spend your money on, potentially the climate impact of that will be tracked. Certain people will be... I mean, this is very much, sounds to me very much like this kind of social credit system in China, Judith.
It is, absolutely. I mean, if you think that they're bringing in digital ID, it's this is something which the current government seems keen to do. So they're thinking, and they're also thinking of bringing in digital banking. That means that if people don't buy things with cash and they buy things with the card, they can track exactly everything that they've been eating and doing and buying and consuming places where they've been traveling to, the amount of petrol that they've been using and so forth. So they can, in that way, track your carbon footprint. It's very worrying. And of course, you know, when you look at the restrictions on cities at the moment, the low traffic zones, I think that a lot of people, I think over half of the people are accepting of those. But if they knew that, that for example, carbons were very disputed, and the only way that that they can make sure that no scientists speak out about natural causes of climate change, and the way that in the past humans have always just adapted, and the environment has just adapted as the climate, as the world has become hotter and cooler, which it has many, many, many times in the past, a lot warmer than it is now. We're still in an ice age. At least half of the period of Earth's history, we haven't been in an ice age. There's been, you know, the poles have been green. So therefore, you can say that people have managed to adapt, and certainly there are some politicians who have actually made that suggestion, but the politicians who make that suggestion aren't heard, and the scientists who are saying, look at what's happening with the sun, it exactly tracks the changes in the atmosphere, aren't heard.
Well, there's another side to all of this, and that is to do with what is the real purpose of this. Is it maybe just to raise more tax? Because traditional ways of raising tax, so for example, through taxing businesses, corporation tax, through taxing income, but largely, I mean, most of the government revenues in the past have come through things like corporation tax, where you've got a thriving economy, thriving business, and you're creaming a little bit off all of the most successful, most profitable businesses to fund what the government does. Well, that's happening less and less and less now, because the economy's collapsing, largely because of privatisation of the infrastructure and the massive prices people are now having to pay for basic things like food, for electricity, for gas, for rent, for water, which is really a fault of Margaret Thatcher in the decade of privatisation in the 1980s. Transport, travel, getting around. We had Andy Hudd from the Train Drivers Union on here last week. You know, £250 return to London from Bath on the train. These sorts of insane amounts of money that people are having to pay, and the corporations are dodging tax by being based in Ireland and offshore and all sorts of things, so they're looking for ways to tax us, you know, more and more. One thing that was talked about this week is the driveway tax, which could be introduced under new plans. Homeowners who pave over their gardens or have a driveway will be charged as part of a new tax proposal. Well, they won't necessarily, but this is just a proposal. But they float these ideas out there. Homeowners in England may be slapped with a new charge under new plans from London Mayor Sadiq Khan, which could see homeowners charged per metre of driveway. It's a bit like that window tax. Do you remember?
I was just thinking exactly the same thing. Everybody will be digging up their drives and their cars will just be driving onto grass.
That's right. They'll have a nice grass driveway or something. You know. Yeah.
Exactly.
But anyway, it's insane, isn't it, really? But anyway, this is what the point I'm trying to make here. The London's Climate Resilience Review, that's what they call it, has highlighted the dangers, which really just means how on earth can we just tax these idiots a bit more for doing the things that they always do and have to do, has highlighted the dangers of paved gardens, suggesting that they contribute to flooding. Because the rain that falls on them doesn't soak into the ground. The report recommends that the government should consider introducing stormwater charges based on the amount of non-porous paved surface in the garden. So that's been reported around the country this week. So the point, I suppose, here is this just a way to get us to be paying more and more for basic stuff like electricity, saying, well, you know, you're going to have to pay more for your electricity, then it will be green.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's been, I think, a 41% increase in traffic fines since the low traffic zones were implemented, and a lot of people are having to pay fines on a regular basis. There was a woman from a London borough who was on Facebook saying that she wanted to pick her mother up to take her mother out, and her mother couldn't sort of walk that well, so she had to go to her house to pick her up. But because her mother's street was a street that she wasn't allowed into, she had to pay a fine every time she went to pick her mother up to take her shopping or to take her to the doctors or whatever. So I think that it is a means of making money. But the other thing, in the net zero plan, they're talking about farms being sustainable, and if a farm area isn't sustainable, then it can be taken over by corporations and foreign governments even. And
well, these charges, for example, say, yeah, if you have a bit of an old car, which actually is less polluting than a brand new Chelsea tractor, you're paying something like £4,500 a year tax now to just drive out of your house. That is, say, if you have to go to work every day. No, I mean, maybe not including weekends, but say it's probably about £3,500 altogether. But this is suddenly a new tax to put onto people. Yeah. Now, this is for the poorer people that can't afford those brand new Chelsea tractors. The other obvious thing to talk about when it comes to these charges like we now have here in Bristol, the clean air zone, they call it, is that, of course, it's not making the air any cleaner because people have to drive extra amount to get around the zone. So they're chucking out loads more pollution into the atmosphere. I have to do it all the time. Yeah. Every time I do it, I think this is just idiotic. This is absurd.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people say that. And, of course, the streets that you can't drive on have lower pollution, and that's meant to be one of the aims of it. But the streets to which you're directed actually have more pollution. In London, they've said that the amount of road use has decreased by 6% with the introduction of these traffic measures. But of course, that could have been just as easily reduced by having a cheap or free transport, not to charge a lot less than £250 to get from London to Bath by train, for example, and to have buses sort of regular and reliable and free, which would mean that a lot of people would use them instead of having a second car, maybe. So I think that there'd be a lot of other ways that you could reduce traffic use by 6% without having the same restrictions.
So anyway, in the meantime, of course, we're being told don't use this car for the sake of the planet, even though, of course, we've now all been made deliberately dependent on cars, or many of us have anyway. We hear in the news here in Bristol, another bus service has been axed following a collapse of a bus company. Bus service started by Transpora earlier this year is going to be shut down. That's last week. The number 23 bus from Broadmead to Ashton Vale, which was the only bus to that part of the city, will now cease operation. The bus service was established after the Ashton Vale community campaign to bring a bus back to the estate following First Bus moving out. The First Bus brought the 24 back, but the bus wasn't used enough, according to this group. Early in the week, Transpora suddenly ceased operating within Bristol and the wider region, putting 13 routes in and around the city out. So three services, the 90 from Hengrove Park to Broadmead and Knoll, the 925 from Newport to Bristol, and the N2 night bus to Stockwood are also being axed. So there's something funny going here, isn't there? So you're being told, don't use the car. Oh, and by the way, the bus service is, the buses are all just going back to the depot and they're not coming back.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, our nearest town is 2 miles away. I live in a village. We can actually have a bus to go from our village to the nearest town where all of the things like doctors, banks, etc., what banks are left, solicitors, you know, the things that you would need in a town. But there's no bus coming back. So, because the bus does a huge circle and goes sort of like via all the other villages to Bath. So if you caught the bus to come back, it would be about maybe a 3 or 4 hour journey. So, which is absolutely ridiculous. So therefore, in effect, you can only, you've got a one way transport system to the nearest town. You know, well.
You could always go on a bicycle.
Yes. Yes, you could. And I've got
a bicycle.
It's
quite dangerous, actually. Yeah. If you're on some of those roads.
And it is a dangerous road. But there are some people, like older people, who can't cycle.
Of course, they're telling the pensioners who live in Ashton Vale, oh, you've got to go and cycle into town. You imagine an 85-year-old trying to get into town on a bicycle in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very, very primitive. It's like primitivism or something.
Absolutely.
Now, what much of this is actually contributing to the cost of living crisis. So, telling people that they must have a car, and even if they, and when they do have a car, then they have to pay extra for it because they haven't got the newest car. They've got to throw away the old car, which again is not very green.
No,
is
it isn't,
not very
is it?
Green. No. Throwing away your old car, it works fine. Yeah. Throw it away, dump it. You know, maybe you should. Yes, just dump it outside Ed Miliband's office somewhere. Mm. But anyway, so the upshot of a lot of this is that it's difficult to actually afford rent and that sort of thing. What I'd like to do now is play you a clip of the guy that got us kicked out of the previous place where we were at Prequels Republic of Stokes Croft. His name's Keith Cowling. I got to know him years ago. And in fact, he removed me from a board years ago because I had supported a woman called Una, who ran a housing association. He was trying to kind of bully her, basically, to get some things sorted out with. And she came back to the meeting, and no, they don't want to do it. And he started having a go at her from the chair. And so I said, hang on a minute, this isn't Una's responsibility. She's asked on your behalf, but it's not, you shouldn't have a go at her. It's just that the people that she's asked don't want to do it. Anyway, from that moment on, my name was Muck, and within a few months, he got me kicked off the board. In fact, what he did is he told me to come to a review at the same time as this show was going out one Friday. So obviously I couldn't do that. And so the next week I got a letter saying you didn't turn up to your review. He didn't give me any alternative times or anything like that. And in fact, you couldn't get hold of him when I tried to call him. Anyway, Keith Cowling is the guy that then took over the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, running that after he'd left the Bristol Community Land Trust, which he got rid of me from. And so here he is talking about how he thinks it's a very bad idea for people to own their own homes. He thinks that groups like the Community Land Trust should own them. It's a bad idea to own your own home. What you should do is, this is what Martin says, actually. Martin Summers on a lot to do with the Germans, because they don't own homes. He has a real downer on people actually owning their own property.
We consider how to respond to the UK housing crisis. Even though owner occupation of residential property peaked in 2002 at almost 70% of the population, it's actually down 5% now after to Tory governments. Our political and economic model is still based on notions of the property-owning democracy. So we've all grown up to see this as normal and desirable, and many of us have, I mean, I hold my hand up, have benefited financially from rapidly rising values of our major light investment in our homes. Since the recent crash, however, when this model was tested almost to destruction by the failures of the big institutional lenders, we started to look more critically at the long-term implications of such a system. And as one or two people, I think Maria talked about the Dutch and the Scandinavian experience, when you look across the channel, this idea that somehow this property owning democracy is natural or desirable, it completely falls apart because they don't do it like that in Europe. Even extremely well-heeled people in Germany live in rented houses, are content to do so, there's no stigma in it. The German housing market is very stable. The costs of housing have risen about 2% a year steadily for 30 years. They're about half what they are. So actually, there are much better ways to do it, and the evidence is not very far away if you want to look for it. Land trusts therefore seek to hold property assets and stewardship in perpetuity. Once asset value financing is rejected, however, assembling finance, as we've already heard from others, and particularly Featherstone, assembling finance to create community-based developments is challenging. Development costs are essentially built up from land costs, building costs, finance costs, professional fees, and developer profit. As CLTs can largely forgo a profit motive once their operating costs are found, but being small, they're largely locked into the same market prices and market mechanisms as commercial or public sector developers. So put simply, therefore, it's not possible to borrow a lot of money, go out and buy a site, commission a design, commission a contractor, build houses, put people in paying social and affordable rents and pay back what you borrowed because the sums don't work. And, once again, heard this already. So what land trusts don't do and what we particularly in Bristol Land Trust do is we try and fill some of that missing gap in the finance. It's about a third, actually, or a quarter, or it depends on the project. We try and do it by getting some public funding, by cross-subsidy, by an element of self-build or self-finish, by a resident capital contribution, as some other people have talked about in co-housing schemes, and also by another aspect of co-housing, which is somewhat untested so far, but we believe in it, which is you don't need to own so much private space if there are very good communal facilities. So in principle, you can take a smaller footprint in your privately owned space and therefore incur less costs.
So there's jolly old Keith Cowling there. He was the chair of Bristol Community Land Trust, then the chair of People's Republic of Stokes Croft and the Land Trust there, who was one of those that got us removed for completely spurious reasons. Basically, we weren't paying enough rent, but they came up with some silly thing to do with transgender leaflet supposedly left in there, which we hadn't even seen, which probably one of those people who wanted us out planted in there. The point is, I've got a bit of an axe to grind with old Keith, but what we've got here is a so-called radical movement, Community Land Trust. But what he's saying throughout that is that, people shouldn't desire to own their own property. He's calling it the property owning democracy. But there is something useful about owning your own home, because Then you're not under threat of eviction.
You have stability.
And it's also something you can hand on to your kids. This is it seems to me an important part of a democratic society is to have that certainty of not being evicted. Then you can start planning for the future. Yeah. What you do is you plan for your kids' kids, because you actually have a stake in the land. In fact, one of the only, I remember Kevin Cahill on this program revealing, as he did in his book, Who Owns the World, that one of the only countries on earth to actually give people absolute property rights over the land that their home is on is Russia. The British don't. The king owns it all.
The king owns the land.
So they can just grab it back off you any time. So a freehold isn't quite as free as we thought it was. So this is, I suppose, what I'm trying to come to here is we're coming towards this. The policy seems to be to impoverish people so they can't afford to own their own home, and also so that if they do own a home through inheritance tax or anything else, they have to sell it.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is an own nothing, be happy world, supposedly.
But that would be all right, Tony, if they were building social housing, decent social housing like they did after the war. I mean, when you look at council houses now, they are a testament to the socialism, the type of socialism that was around in the 1940s and 1950s, because they're nice houses, solidly built, large gardens, and really there were things that families wanted to live in. Well, nowadays, if families are looking for a property to rent, they can't get social housing. It's virtually non-existent.
Well, the best thing, it seems to me, if you go look at these new housing estates, and I literally... I try and turn away now. I see them built by the side of the road, new housing. There's loads of new housing up near Cribbs Causeway as you head up towards the M5 and over the bridge to Wales from here. Massive, massive amount of new housing. It's tiny little rooms. In fact, the building regulations have been slimmed right down. As we were hearing a few weeks ago, for students, there's virtually none, so they can stick them in a little shoebox. And if you go back to even council houses that were built in the 1960s, they're far bigger than the modern houses which are being so sold off as so-called affordable housing for people to buy.
Absolutely. Yeah, and affordable housing isn't really affordable anyway.
Oh, that's another thing. Quite right. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's hopefully housing covered a bit there as to what's going on in the wider picture is why we're being taxed. We will come back to climate now, though, because I'd like to look at the whole war on farmers, they call it. What do you make of that? Did you get any of that in your course at all to do with farming and the policy to do with
No. The course was just factual information about how what controls the climate.
Yes, but it's very important. Farming is so important.
Farming is very important. And of course, you know, we've talked a little bit about that with the carbon credits, with subsidence farmers and small farmers in the developing world being thrown off the land now. In order to plant trees, so we have to. But looking at it in England, I mean, the situation is quite amazing, because they've increased the cost of fuel. I think it used to be 20p a litre, and it's now £1. They've increased the amount of bureaucracy, and so now it's really difficult to farm and actually make a profit. And then the government at the beginning of the year said that people could get. Accounts that have said £300 an acre and some accounts that have said £250 an acre for leaving their land to wild. And
the solar farms, they get around about £1,000 an acre.
Which is absolutely ridiculous. And
why is it? No, because this is a way of generating sustainable electricity. I mean, what's the principles when it comes to solar farms on, a farmer? Surely, if they're going to get, say, £200 an acre for growing cereals or whatever, they'd be stupid not to turn over their land to a solar farm for a grand an acre.
Well, apparently the costs now are really tight on per, you know, it's very difficult to make a profit on some land at all. So if the government's going to pay you £250 an acre for doing nothing, and if you give up your whole farm, you then sort of... Can take a sort of a golden handshake.
Farmers are tenant farmers, so they don't actually own the farm anyway. No. So the owner might say, well, I just want you out of the way.
Yeah.
We're going to have a load of solar panels here. In fact, they are doing that.
Yeah.
Increasingly, there's a massive solar farm going up near Oxford. Yeah. There's another one near the M5 in Gloucestershire. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The campaign, there are big local campaigns to stop these.
But the net zero policy, which I think is going to really take hold after 2030, although already there are moves in that direction, they're actually saying that they're going to reduce the number of sheep, reduce the number of cows, and they're going to reduce the amount of imported food. Now, if they've taken land out of production, and they're then going to... Some lands are only suitable for sheep. You know, when you get highlands, the only things that they can grow are sheep, so if they're going to say that land has got to be rewilded, and therefore the sheep population goes, and some areas which are very heavy are only suitable for cattle. You can't really grow arable on it very easily, so you take those out of production. Already the number of cows that are actually grazing has actually gone down in any case, because of a dairy is much milking is much less common in UK, and then you're saying that you can't import food. Well, what's going to happen to the price of food? I mean, you're talking about the prices of housing out of people's reach. But if they can't afford rent and they also can't afford food, you know, you're putting families into a very difficult situation.
I mean, this is price fixing going on within the supermarkets as well. So it's almost as if they're trying to put the food up even more than the fact that they can put the food prices up because there is a cartel. You know, you can't get it from anywhere else other than one of the big supermarket chains, where a lot of the food that we're buying. So they do. And another thing just occurs to me, I think it was in the news yesterday or today, was the Competition and Markets Authority have found that they're price fixing the supermarkets, and not just price fixing their food, they're price fixing their petrol too, their petrol and diesel that they sell. They're making excessive profits. Now, I don't know if the Competitions and Market Authority have got any muscle to stop them doing that. But it seems to me what's going on is a consolidation. I think they call it vertical integration, don't they? Where businesses, what they do is they try and totally, once they completely control a market, then they will just start price fixing for their shareholders. And they'll tell their shareholders, look, now we control this market. In this case, we're talking about supermarket fuel. We will just funnel a load of extra money to the shareholders.
Yes, unfortunately, I think that a lot of farming is suffering from contracts that they've got with supermarkets. And, I mean, it's not only the price that they control, but also the goods. If they've contracted to provide cauliflowers, but then when the cauliflowers go along, they're bigger than the ones that they want, then they refuse the whole order. And then the farmer is left with sort of like, you know, cauliflowers, oversized cauliflowers in his field that he can't sell. I think that some farmers now are, I mean, for example, there are one or two delivery schemes that we belong to one now, where vegetables are sort of like delivered from a consortium of local farms and independent farmers. And I think they do get a better price there. And I think some farms are starting to do the same thing with sort of milk and beef, for example. So you can buy direct from farms. But I think that if farmers have contracts with the supermarket or with the milk marketing board, they're really not making any money at all.
The Competition and Markets Authority today, CMA, has stated that the fuel market continues to fail consumers a year after its initial report exposed issues price fixing in the sector. It highlighted that retailers' fuel margins, the gap between what they pay for the fuel and the price they sell it at, remains significantly above historic levels. In 2023 alone, increases in fuel margins cost drivers more than £1.6 billion, with supermarkets running double roughly what they were in 2019 profits per gallon or per litre that they're making. So you can't really calculate exactly what extra price they're putting on. The CMA has suggested that the real-time data finding scheme would allow motorists to save about £5 every time they fill up. So that extra £5 is going to the supermarket. Now, this is just one example of the sort of oligopoly we're living in and the control. But to get back to farming, let's run through a few clips here, Judith, if you don't mind, to do with various. And we'll start with Glenn Beck, who does a podcast. I think it's a sort of YouTube show or something, where he's talking about this thing. Well, they call it the war on farmers.
You look at China. They didn't even need an excuse there. They just said, get off this land, peasants. We built you apartments in the cities. If you don't like it, we're going to torture you and kill you. Mm. So they move. Then you look at what's happening in the Netherlands. You look at Sri Lanka. You look at the United States. Different pretexts, right? Climate change, saving a desert tortoise, you know, whatever it is. But it's all aimed at undermining the independent farmer and rancher. So where are they going with it? They want a system where food is entirely controlled and entirely centralized, literally from the seed, as you pointed out. They actually want to patent the DNA of the seeds and the livestock for every organism that we eat, and they're working on that. Right? Bill Gates, his dad was a patent attorney. They understood early on that controlling the intellectual property, controlling the food and the energy is the way to control humanity. So when you look at this war on farmers, it seems to me that the intended consequences is total domination of mankind. But then you look at people like Bill Gates. This is a man who's got more wealth than anybody could ever possibly know what to do with. I don't believe it's about money anymore for people like Bill Gates. I believe it's about control. And you can really discern that just from what they're saying publicly.
But it's not
control just because, it's an ideology that he has believed in for a long time. We have to reduce the population.
Yep.
You know, he's doing it for all of these reasons, but he's not being honest with anybody. He's not coming out and saying those. He's eating around the fringes of it. When you listen to his speeches, you can put them together and go, oh my gosh.
Yeah,
but he'd deny that.
Of course. No totalitarian with any sense ever said, hey, guys, I want to control your life. Hey, guys, I want to take a lot of your money. I want to control what you do on your farm. No totalitarian ever said that. It's always packaged as, you know, this is for your benefit. It's because I love you. It's because I know better.
Yeah, it's like the hard sell. So it really is changing a lot, farming. That was the Glenn Beck show. It's called War on Farmers. But we've got something here which is, in a way, quite a lot closer to home, which is just here in North Somerset. There is a farming group which has been campaigning to protect farmers from some of these new policies. They want to do something called reseeing North Somerset. Now, this is a part, well, actually, you're not far from there, are you? The Somerset Levels.
Yeah.
And why on earth would they want to re-see it? Any idea?
Re-see,
yeah. So they want the sea back in. You know where the levels were drained centuries ago.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
And the idea is, let's let the sea back in. Now, I know for a fact someone who was, I think it was actually Joe Banks, was talking to us on this program a few weeks ago, and he was saying he was down on the levels, may have said it on the show, he may have just said it to me at the pub afterwards or something, but he explained how a guy he'd stayed with in an Airbnb down in the Somerset Levels and said he's stuck there, he can't sell his house, he can't get insurance for his present house because of the floods a few years ago. So anyway, let's just catch up on what's going on down there as farmers explain what problems that they're having. And this whole plan of turning that whole area of Somerset back into sea again, rewilding it apparently, for wild animals and not for farming.
On one side of me is sea, on the other side is land. In the middle is a dirty great nuclear reactor. I'm on the North Somerset coast next to Hinkley Point. Now, when Hinkley Point, which is under reconstruction at the moment, reopens, it's going to need to pump seawater, and that's going to have a bad effect on sea fish. How bad an effect? Well, our brilliant government has come up with a number. It's going to have a bad effect on 800 acres of fish. So what our brilliant government proposes is that EDF, the owner of Hinkley Point, offsets that by flooding 800 acres of land with seawater. Yes, EDF, one of Europe's largest companies, is going to re-sea North Somerset.
What we're looking at is the Paulet Hams, a great area of both grazing land and used for arable, and of course full of livestock, and traditionally some of the best grazing land in the country. And for us, taking it away and creating a salt marsh, which will not enhance the fish population, will just be an absolute nonsense. It's a greenwashing, it's ticking of boxes, it's political correctness at its worst.
This is offsetting. Back in the 1970s, it was called mitigation. You may have come across people with environmental science degrees doing nicely out of bat hotels and great crested newt water parks, where wildlife wiped out by development is replaced with the same species elsewhere. On the face of it, it makes sense. Many people believe that hedgehogs should be on council housing lists. But flounders and mullet?
This is supposed to be a fish breeding enterprise, which none of us, including their good selves, dare I say it, have got much faith in. Because if you talk to EDF, and it was a pity we couldn't have them here today, you'll find that when you start talking about the fish, they get very quiet and they look rather shamed-faced, in my view. So I think you'll find the whole thing is a tick-boxing exercise.
I think the surveyors came from London, hadn't actually ever been on site, you know, so they didn't actually know what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, Neil, you've been at the heart of government. the sort of planning by Google Maps, does it really take place?
I think it does. You see, George Eustace, just before he retired as minister, you know, for DEFRA, he was the one who signed this one off and said, you are going to reduce the fish population in the Bristol Channel, so you have to have mitigation. And so they ticked the box and they said, right, OK, we'll find 800 acres. They come to the Hams. They were East London consultants. They were coming around. They had notices on our land. They didn't come and consult us first. The first thing we knew of it is when, you know, outside of our house, we came back one night and there were two or three posters nailed to the fence saying that they were going to take the land. And we thought they were going to take it right back to our farms and beyond. We even had one in a field we've got running to the village, which is 100 feet above sea level. I did decide that we'd need quite a long, big snorkel where we're living if they were going to flood that one. They had no idea what they were doing. And when I tackled a couple of these guys, I apologised to them afterwards for being so blunt, but I said, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And they said, well, you seem to have all got together around here. And I said, well, yes, we have, because we've lived here a very long time. And we, you know, for four generations, our families have been here. We're not going to just let you roll us over. And they didn't have a clue where the land was.
I think they had trouble mainly because the land hadn't been sold for 100 years. So there's no records of who owns it. That was what they were struggling with. So they put all their little letters down saying, who owns this land? And nobody would tell them.
Well, not only did you have to say whether you owned it, you had to say whether you had a mortgage on it, and all of these details. Well, look, I'm sorry, I don't sort of just reply to somebody's letter in the post, do I have a mortgage on this? And you know, I mean, farmers are, over the years, we're quite private over our finances, and we like to, you know, like to keep a lot of that to ourselves. And I think the whole thing was so badly handled, and I think what it's done is it's upset everybody. But I think the trouble is they've wound us right up by the way they started doing it, and two, they haven't proven their case, because this is a material change, you see, to their original planning permission, so it will need to go before an inspector in Bristol.
Well, there is, I'm not sure of the name of the campaign, but I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Is a former MP there and a North Somerset farmer as the government's plan to re-see North Somerset. Now, you get an idea, it's very much like I was saying about Iraq. Yeah. So what we've had here is we've had a deindustrialisation, and now it's a de-agriculturalisation.
Absolutely, it is, because they're taking farmland out of production. Even in our village, there's 2.8% of the agricultural land is grade one farmland, and Farrington Gurney is grade one farmland, and they want to build 500 houses, have a solar farm and have an enterprise park on Farrington Gurney's grade one agricultural land, when it's so rare. Now why would they want to encroach on farmland, which is so precious? And you know, if they want to build houses, or if they want to have their solar farms, maybe they need to put it onto land that isn't so productive.
Well, this was one of the reasons I think maybe Extinction Rebellion was cooked up, is to sort of steer environmentalists down a rabbit hole, which has nothing to do with the real environmental crisis, which is that the planning regulations are now being torn up, and that big sheds are being built all over our countryside now with the new Labour government. They've said that they really are going to tear it, so you can pretty much build anywhere. The whole idea of the green belt is gone. I mean, that to me is a far bigger environmental problem. But anyway, before we get, let's carry on with farmers, and I'm hoping we'll get a little bit on this court case that there was last week about all the environmentalists being arrested on the M25, and the final result of that, but many of them going down for longest jail sentences for any protest, and we'll be hearing why. But if you go down to Dartmoor, you'll find there's some horrible things been going on with the Dartmoor ponies. Here's a Dartmoor pony farmer explaining that he's basically being driven out of a livelihood.
I'm here on my home of Dartmoor on the common, checking the ponies and the sheep and the cows that graze here. We've been farming on the moor for generations, and all of that is under threat due to an amendment in the House of Lords to the Environmental Bill, which would remove common rights from the land and from the indigenous people that farm it and take it back into control of the state. Now, people have been farming Dartmoor since the Bronze Age. There's a hut circle there where early settlements used to be, and common rights were first recognised in law in the Magna Carta in 1215 or something like that, long time since I was at school. And all of this is under threat due to an amendment in the House of Lords. Now, everything on the moor, the whole landscape, the birds, the wildlife, is under threat due to the removal of stock. All the livestock here has created the whole environment. Everything is here because of the livestock. The way they browse and forage has led to the open heather moorland that you see.
So that's an unnamed farmer from down on Dartmoor. There's a lot of people saying that these old common rights are now being extinguished, and you can see quite obviously people being forced out of business, being told by Natural England and by various government agencies, Environment Agency, etc., that they are not allowed to farm. For example, they're not allowed to, they own the rights on this land, that they can graze their sheep there, but they're being told no, you can't anymore, either for certain months of the year. And so all these many of these common rights are being extinguished. Now, I've heard about this in Wales, in Dartmoor, in the New Forest, and in Cumbria. All these, well, many of these open moorlands, and now we're being told, no, you can't have any ponies. Now, as he interestingly says there, they've been doing this since the Bronze Age.
Absolutely. And it moves on. I mean, we've been talking about rights since the last century, since this green movement started. They've been moving people off their land, and they're doing it in the developing world, and they're doing it in our world. You know, this
is just a form of enclosure, surely.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
Enclosures from people that aren't all that familiar with them were mostly in the 17 and 1800s, 18th and 19th century, and they were private acts of parliament where people were evicted from the land and their cottages were crushed. They were mostly people who had a living on a copyhold in the old and the ancient, it's a medieval open field system, and so those lands that they used to farm, that they had the right on these massive allotments to farm for centuries, they were then living in a ditch. They had nowhere to live, and the bigger landowner who passed this, and by the way, of course, they couldn't vote in those days. So these big landowners were voting for their own to basically privatise their own land. Were mostly turned over to sheep, but it seems like we've got another kind of almost another version of the enclosures going on today, with people who own their own land actually being told, no, you don't, and you can't make money on your land. We're going to force you into bankruptcy, and you're going to have to sell to Bill Gates or some big corporation.
Net Zero actually says that if you're not farming sustainably, the government can take your land and allow corporations to take over the land. And so if you're farming the land productively, it can be taken off you and rewilded.
Well, you know, what a lot of farmers will do is they'll say, no, we're farming sustainably. They'll go along with it for a bit, which is in a way a trick, because really they need to fight it. They need to stop it, because if you go along with it, then it will get even worse.
It will.
And actually, there are quite a lot of protests going on. A few weeks ago, there was another one in Cardiff.
Yes,
I believe that the government really want to destroy farmers. They want to get rid of the small farmers in particular. I know that the UN agenda, by 2050, they want to phase out meat. And unfortunately, the population isn't aware of the plan. They want to replace that then with lab-grown meat. And Bill Gates are heavily into that. He's highly invested into that. And who knows what the side effects of that is.
What are the subsidies asking you to do that you're not happy with?
Plant 10% of our land in trees, 10% habitats, 5% ponds.
The scheme basically will be paying for environmental and habitat changes. They will not be supporting food production. So you will be losing land to trees, you'll be losing land to habitats. and the money that they'll be paying you will be to pay for that. So the farmers themselves will not be getting any expendable income, if you like, which will not support food production. We need support for food production.
There was a study released that said that there would be something like 5,500 farmers put out of business by the changes in government subsidy schemes. And those farmers, especially, are family farms, you know, with ties to their local community. It's going to have a knock-on effect in terms of the loss of people from the land. And to me personally, what I want is family farmers and small family farms and people producing the food, not corporations, because that's what's happening. There's a green agenda, which is essentially corporations buying up farmland to plant trees on. And we can't eat trees.
The subsidies that we get and the changes that are being proposed, they're going to bankrupt me. They're going to put me out of business. The way things are looking, we're going to have to take a large chunk of what acreage we've got out of production, and we don't have the capacity to take that hit to our finances if we don't sign up. We can't compete with other countries who don't have our welfare and hygiene standards.
You know, try not to go to your supermarkets, see if there's any local farmers markets, any local butchers, and just sort of support them instead of the supermarkets. Because they're taking all the profit out, not giving it to the farmer.
We've had 24 years now of being organic, and the amount of fodder we produce now is equivalent to what we produced in the 1970s, but without pouring fertiliser and chemicals all over the land. We can give up 20% of the land in Wales, and then we can import food from South America, and they'll cut down a whole load more rainforest to produce it. And that's what will happen. And I don't know, we'll find out whether people care. If people care, they'll use their feet to vote at the supermarket, and they'll use their wallet. I believe that if people can buy local, if it can be produced locally and marketed locally, purchased locally and consumed locally, that's massively beneficial to the environment. So that's why I've come to Cardiff today, to get involved in this protest.
So that's the final of our clips on land and housing. Judith, there's a massive change is going on out there.
Yeah, it
many,
is.
Many of the farmers just seem to be, well, they're up in arms about it, but they're not entirely sure which direction to go.
No, and the difficulty is, of course, when food goes up in price and there's a shortage of food, they're going to blame it on climate change, whereas in fact it's caused by the government's policies on agriculture. And a lot of people, because these changes to farming haven't been publicised, and even the farmers' protests aren't widely publicised on
no,
the
you're
mainstream
right.
media.
They have thousands of tractors, and it doesn't get on the news at all.
Exactly. And so therefore, when the government says there's not enough food because it's climate change, a lot of people will actually believe that.
They will. Yeah, maybe that's what they're cooking up. Anyway, finally, before we say goodbye to you, before we have our break, Judith, we're going to have a listen to this stupendous court case last week where Roger Hallam, who's one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, and a whole bunch of other climate activists in 2022 shut down the M25 for several hours. They were up on the gantries and that sort of thing. So before we hear the report on the court case, what do you make of this sort of protest? Because they're doing everything they can. They're not really targeting the protest at the people causing the trouble. No. They're targeting them very generally at members of the public that need to get from A to B.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's going to mean that they're going to lose any sort of like publicity, any sympathy from the general public anyway.
So they're getting their publicity, but for many people are looking at it and thinking, what a bunch of idiots. They're not in sympathy. In other words, they're not trying to carry the population with them, are they?
No, they're not. No.
So let's have a listen now. This is from this week's media show on Radio 4, where we hear a fascinating clip from Roger Hallam, the founder of Extinction Rebellion, explaining really to his followers why they're doing what they're doing. And the idea is we need to just get maximum publicity. And also explaining why they got such long sentences is that they just decided that they wanted to use the court case to get publicity too.
Last week, five protesters from the group were jailed because of their involvement in protests that brought part of the M25 to a standstill. That was in 2022. We're particularly interested in this story because a key piece of evidence was a Zoom call recorded by the Sun journalist Scarlett Howes, who had infiltrated the group. The Zoom call showed Just Stop Oil's leader, Roger Hallam, setting out the plan. This is a little bit of it.
If we do it for one day, it's going to be massive, but so what, right? If it goes on for 2 days, it's going to be global news. If it goes for 3-4 days, you're in the ballpark of the biggest disruption in British modern history. We are not going to influence government policy by just going through the motions.
So that was a Zoom call recorded by the Sun journalist, and the Sun was later thanked by the judge in the case. Well, Damien Gale, The Guardian's climate correspondent, watched the whole trial, and he's here. Damien, thank you for coming on the media show. You described the trial in your reporting as the UK's wildest climate trial. What happened?
Well, it really was like nothing I've ever seen before as a journalist covering court cases, and I've covered quite a few. It all seemed, aside from this remarkable piece of evidence from The Sun, this recording of the five defendants making what was effectively a recruitment call to try to enlist people to take part in this protest, the prosecution case ran pretty much as we have come to expect with these climate trials. The defendants didn't contest any of the evidence against them. They effectively did not bother to deny, aside from Roger Hallam, deny that they had taken part in this protest. And it was when the defence started that things started to get really interesting. The defendants decided that they were going to turn the courtroom into a site of civil resistance. And by that, they meant that they were going to extend their civil disobedience protests from the streets into the courts. In effect, what this meant was that they were not going to abide by any of the instructions that the judge gave them, and they were going to use the opportunity of being in court as a platform to make their views known about the climate crisis. But the judge had ruled that evidence about climate breakdown was not relevant to the case, and so that put them in conflict with the court from the very beginning. As soon as they started to give their evidence, they wanted to give a case of reasonable excuse and justified in doing what it was that they did, because the urgency of the climate crisis was so severe that any rational person would have done the same thing if they knew. Now, in effect, what that meant was that when they went into the witness box to give evidence on their own behalf, they immediately started to give evidence which the judge had ruled was out of order and not pertinent to the case.
And were you reporting that? How did your coverage work?
So the judge ruled that they couldn't give evidence about climate change, but as your listeners may well be aware, when it comes to reporting the courts in the UK, we can report pretty much anything that's said in front of the jury. Whenever the jury is not present, we can't report on anything that happens until the conclusion of the trial.
And were there dramatic things happening when the jury weren't present that you then couldn't report on?
Oh, well, yeah. So this conflict that they ended up finding themselves in with the judge, while they were trying to give the jury lectures on the meaning of the law and the reason why they ought to have a reasonable excuse, the judge was getting more and more irate and irritated, sending the jury out, instructing them to keep to the facts of the case as he's determined that they were, until it got to the point where defendants decided that they would refuse to leave the witness box until they'd been allowed to give the evidence which they had come to court to give, and to give the full story which they thought the jury ought to hear.
But the jury weren't there, and you couldn't report this, or how did
well,
it work?
It's when they started to give that full story which the judge decided the jury ought not to hear, that he would send the jury out. He then would order them to leave the witness box. They refused, and that's when police started to be called into court.
So there you go. That's a little clip from yesterday or a couple of days ago's media show on Radio 4, Judith, explaining really what happened there, which I didn't realise, largely because it hadn't been reported. So not only are the Extinction Rebellion and Roger Hallam not interested in carrying the public with them, they're not interested in carrying the courts with them either.
No, it seems not. I hadn't heard that before. That story was completely new to me, so I'm quite interested to hear it.
Here's a dilemma for you, though. Back in the old days, reasonable excuse would have been allowed in the court. For some reason now, it's all been gotten rid of. You're not allowed to have any reasonable excuse. So, you know, the idea is, if there's a particular reason why, for example, back in the day, we had the, Trident Ploughshares girls that went into a British Aerospace, factory and smashed up some Hawk aircraft that were going to Indonesia. But they were allowed off. They said, well, this is actually stopping a greater crime. Now, the same sorts of things, the people who have been destroying, making a mess of the Elbit factories over the Israeli genocide, they're trying to bring that into court. We're trying to stop a greater crime. And in a way, what Extinction Rebellion are doing exactly the same. They're saying, well, look, this is a small crime compared to the big crime of climate change. So actually, maybe in the background of all this is the way our justice system has been changing to say, well, we're only interested in the bare facts of the case, that you can't bring any kind of excuse about crimes going on elsewhere that you're trying to stop.
Yes, well, I think that, that really does seriously handicap, doesn't it, the people who are protesting about really genuine things, like, for example, the East Timor thing. And it was the protests against the East Timor occupation that actually gave it its independence, ultimately. I think that it's quite interesting because with the ICJ ruling on Palestine and the occupation of Palestine last week, you would have thought that that would mean that people who were protesting because crimes against humanity and genocide and which has been proved by the ruling of the International Court of Justice, you would think that that would could be taken into account, but maybe it can't.
Well, maybe that's what's going on here, is as some of our elites are committing horrific crimes, including genocide, cooperating with genocide, so the judges are being told, well, you better not include anything else. It's just the bare facts of the case. If someone has done something because it's stopping thousands of people being killed elsewhere, it doesn't matter anymore.
No.
I mean, maybe that's what we've been witnessing.
Maybe.
Bit by bit. Anyway, Judith, your blog post on your... Well, it's not really... Substack is a blog, really,
Substack is a blog. It's a blog that at the moment they're not censoring, but
it allows people to also to donate to you if they like what you're doing.
Everything is completely free on my Substack, so because I want people to get the information about censorship.
What people do is they make it free until you get thousands and thousands and thousands of followers, then they start to charge you. But some people have done that, I've noticed on Substack. But anyway, that's the point, really. But whereabouts can people find it?
It's Judith Brown's Substack, The Control of Information. So if they do that on an internet search, it should come up.
It's a terrific topic. It's something we deal with all the time, the control of information, Judy. So lovely to have you back. One of the main problems is the lack of trust in the British press seems to be fueling a lot of this. In the old days, the journalists did have this idea of balance. No one's going to pretend that a journalist is not biased. They're all biased. The editors are all biased. They've all got their own points of view. But the idea is that you're supposed to include all the various points of view, but we're not seeing very much of that anymore.
No,
why is that?
Not. I think that because a lot of people who've got lots of money and a lot of people who are in power have just decided that they want to control everything that people get to know.
It's maybe a bit like what we were saying in that the privatisation of nature documentary, which I will put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is that the corporates, the transnationals, have got so powerful they've managed to bribe and lobby and maybe even kill their way into making sure that the regulations to preserve for the benefit of the rest of the population were rolled back and the corporations started to take over. And so they've now decided that we're going to actually control all the markets around all these issues and the environment. In fact, that's one of the scariest things about that film is where it talks about, well, all these things are happening out there in nature, in the environment, and these little animals are growing and these plants are growing. But that it's all happening for free.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, yeah. So control of information. Well, yes, you don't get too much of that on this program. That's Dr. Judith Brown. Thanks very much, Judith, for joining us once more.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Tony. So hope your new studio settles down and you don't have the technical problems next week.
Yes, let's hope so. And we'll hope to be having a chat with Martin after the break.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Bye.
You've seen him on the street today, heading for some sleaze cafe. He wasn't alone. He wasn't alone. Some beauty hung onto his arm. I shouldn't need to be alarmed now. He's done it before. Yes, he's done it before. How I don't want to know. You think she's one of his old flames, some fiery looking kind of day. You found her dope, but just the same, she stole the show. I don't want to know. Isn't it a crime? You wouldn't mention any name. Afraid I couldn't stand the pain or take a blow. Well, I don't want to know. Seen him on the downtown side, drinking hard and acting wild. He was not alone, not on his own. You say he looked a sorry sight. You know he's had another fight. Well, he's done it before. Yes, he's done it before. Where and how, I don't want to know. A smile breaks on your poker face. Tell me you're gonna throw the ace of spades and drop it and watch me fall on evil days. Why don't I try to understand? He's just as weak as any other man. He'll come back to me in the end. Now isn't that so? Oh, I don't wanna know.
dollar. All because they fought to liberate Cuba. Now they're out to mash Nicaragua with their plans to squash Sandinista. Every day they slander and perjure. They're the masters of torture and murder. Don't believe what you hear from the media. They're the ones who kill Victor Jara. Don't believe what you hear about Chile. They're the ones who topple Allende. In the liberation of Zimbabwe, they were there to try to stop Mugabe. If you don't believe that they're evil, look what they've done to the Cambodian people. Nixon, Reagan, they're all the same. Constantly, they downburst again. If you trust the Pentagon, you wind up in Vietnam. Nixon, Reagan, they're all the same. Constantly, they downburst again.
Do you want them
to represent you?
Do you want them
to run the country?
Do you want them
to run the world?
Do you want them
to make your decisions?
Do you want them
to make up your mind?
Do you want them
to be your master?
Do you want them
to rule your fate? No, no. Zimbabwe, they were there to try to stop Mugabe. If you don't believe
that are evil. Look what they done to the Cambodian people. CID. 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 Strong right arm of the USA. CID. 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 Strong armed thugs of the USA.
Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activists now on the line and me, Tony Gosling. The music you just heard there was, to begin with, that was Seek Ye First the Kingdom of God. That's the choir of Guildford Cathedral. And I don't think that's there, just the choir. That's a load of kids, wasn't it? Pretty much recorded in Guildford Cathedral. And then there's I Don't Want to Know, that's Vaya con Dios. And finally, it's a studio version of a song I played a few weeks ago. This guy, I love him, Dan Del Shannon, from the late 1980s, and I think he sort of disappeared in the 1990s. If anyone knows anything about what happened to Dan Del Shannon, do please let me know. But that's the studio version of his program, or his CIA song. He's got lots of other interesting songs, that fella, and I might dig out some more for the music at the end of the show or in a future week. So, yes, anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And we're going to plunge in, I think, straight away pretty much to look at this film about accelerationism. But before we do, just picking up on some of the, because it was such a big show, Martin. Can you hear me okay, by the way?
Yes, I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, last week about Trump. Any more developments on that front? We've got Netanyahu over there this week, haven't we?
Well, I mean, obviously that's the most significant event of the week. It's Netanyahu getting a standing ovation from all of these politicians in the United States. Meanwhile, he's wanted as an international criminal by the International Criminal
Court.
Well,
I don't know if they've actually issued an arrest warrant, have they?
They have issued an arrest warrant for him, haven't they?
Right.
So they should arrest. Of course, obviously, the US is not a signatory to the ICC convention, so they're not obliged to do anything. But if Netanyahu turned up in Britain, we would be expected to arrest him.
Well, I'm not sure we would anymore.
Not only does he not get arrested, he's got all these people. He got 57 standing ovations in a one-hour speech. Meanwhile, the slaughter continues in Gaza.
So why is it that the Americans are so swivel-eyed about this? Is it just this amazing thing called Christian Zionism? They all think it's all part of God's work?
That is an important thing on the right wing of US politics, certainly, where they, you know, they don't actually have a rational comprehension of any of it. But even on the so-called left wing of democratic politics, lots of people are funded by the Israeli lobby. And if they're not funded, but, you know, if you stand against them, they kick you out. I mean, they try and get rid of you. They spend millions of dollars to make sure you are not elected. So that's why, obviously, opinion polls in the US show a majority of people want a ceasefire and want Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. But that's not represented in the Congress, because to get elected in the US, you need millions and millions and millions of dollars. And where do they come from? Well, they come from the Israeli lobby. And if you go against the Israeli lobby, they will spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to get you kicked out, as happened to you know, various people over the years. So, you know, even if you wanted to challenge them, you'd think twice. And that's what we see, this slavish. I mean, the rest of the world watches this slavish adulation of somebody who is now a wanted international war criminal, still carrying out his evil acts. And of course, he justified everything he was doing with talking about, we are the civilized ones, we're fighting barbarians. And he's getting claps and cheers for that from US politicians, who are all, of course, millionaires. There's nobody in the US Congress who isn't at least a millionaire. No Jeremy Corbyn's there, eh?
Well, apparently Netanyahu has got upset with Kamala Harris. She has made some remarks after meeting Netanyahu. The two met in Washington. After the meeting, Harris said it was time for a ceasefire in Gaza, and Netanyahu claims her statement set back any potential agreement with Hamas.
Well, I think that's smart politics by Kamala Harris, because if what she could do, Biden wasn't able to do it. But she could turn around and say, actually, I'm going to be the sort of US president that tells the Israelis what to do instead of them telling us what to do. I don't know whether she dares to do it, but since she's already where she is, they can't really stop her. And that must worry them, because if she was to take advice, look, this is time to put it, you know, time for us to chuck our weight around a bit here. She's in a position to do that because she's already where she is. Anybody else trying to do that would be brushed aside. But I doubt whether she will, because the pressures, you know, hardly anybody dares. Bernie Sanders dared, of course. I mean, him and various other people didn't turn up to the whole event.
It seems a bit strange that we've now got a Democrat leader that's at least pretending that she doesn't agree with the Israelis, whereas actually but the Biden administration has been going along with it all the way.
Yes, but they've also been
Martin, is this just electioneering, do you think?
Oh, yes, it's electioneering by her insofar as she said it. But, of course, it's a question of how far she feels she can go. I mean, she may decide that I might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, because whatever I say against the Israelis, they're gonna hate me. They want Trump, obviously. Trump's promise in the West Bank. Trump's promised them a war with Iran. That's what they want, and that's what he's offered them.
Anyway,
Noga
Tanapolsky is an Israeli journalist who discussed earlier this week on LBC quite a lot about the visit by Netanyahu to Washington.
The Israeli public is extremely unhappy at his behavior. Somewhere between 70 and 80% of Israelis in every single poll disapprove of his handling of the war and certainly disapprove of what he's doing now. I mean, I can even give you small kind of intimate details of this visit, which is that Netanyahu invited a certain number of families of Israeli hostages still being held in Gaza to join him on this trip, kind of, you know, to display them or to bring them along as he addressed Congress, I think in the hope that their presence would, I don't know what, make an impression on Americans. And in fact, what has happened is the prime minister, as is his wont, decided to add an extra weekend onto his trip. This was long suspected that he would do it because he has a son living in Miami, an adult son who lives on the Israeli public dime for no good reason. And his birthday is on Saturday. And so there were rumors all week long here in Israel that Netanyahu would try and add a weekend to his trip so he could celebrate his son's birthday. And that is exactly what has happened. He's flying down to Florida Friday, ostensibly to visit Donald Trump, but basically to celebrate his son's birthday. And thus, he is stranding these family members of hostages held in Gaza who flew over with him and have no arrangements to be able to come back home and are certainly not invited to the Netanyahu family party.
Oh, I see. They went over on the prime ministerial plane to there and they just got to hang loose while he does the Florida leg of the trip.
That's right. But they're also not invited to fly down to Florida and then return with him, you know, whenever he decides to come back. Right.
How significant the putting into the schedule the Donald Trump visit, is that just coincidence because he's in Florida for the Suns thing anyway? Or do you think he would have gone to see Mr. Trump because he reckons that he's going to be the next president?
Well, you know, he hopes. I don't know what he reckons. He hopes he'll be the next president. But also, he's, I think, a bit concerned about Trump, whose recent comments about Netanyahu have been not complimentary and even, you know, kind of vulgarities. He's kind of cursed him. Donald Trump remains very angry at Netanyahu because Netanyahu did recognize Joe Biden's electoral win back in 2020. And that Trump mentions this really at every opportunity that he can talk about Netanyahu. The other thing is that Trump has made it pretty clear he does not support the U.S. sending foreign military aid to any country, not to Ukraine and not to Israel. So all of this is inconvenient, and I think that Netanyahu is aiming to try and patch things over.
Noga, good to talk to you as ever. Noga Tarnopolsky joining us live from Jerusalem.
Interesting stuff she's got there, Martin. Some interesting angles she's got there, Martin, hasn't she? That is to say that Trump has been getting quite belligerent about Netanyahu because he didn't support his contesting the election result.
Yes, I mean they've fallen out. Of course, the other thing Trump said about Netanyahu is that he assassinated Soleimani, Trump, and Netanyahu didn't want to put his fingers on the trigger and said it was all up to Trump and that's Trump's decision. And he said, I did it for him, yet he didn't want to actually, you know, he made me the fall guy for it. There's obviously going to be tensions in this relationship because it's basically a blackmail relationship between Israel and US
politicians. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if maybe it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall, wouldn't it, between these two, Trump and Netanyahu. It's almost as if you imagine Netanyahu saying, look, Trump, you're going to have to behave yourself, otherwise we won't miss next time.
Well, it may be, of course. I mean, the theories are out there on the internet, Tony, that it was the Zionists who tried to assassinate or set up the assassination of Trump in order to try and make sure that Biden didn't win and all the rest of it. Anyway, that's a very big worm.
Well, hang on. You know, what is there any evidence of a Zionist connection?
I'm just telling you what sort of chatter there is out on the internet, Tony. You will know. Everybody goes into these things and everybody's crawling all over it.
But there's also masses of disinformation. You know, I tend to discard most things unless there's some decent evidence for it.
Well, indeed, I'm just saying that one of the things, it's just a fact that people are talking about all these different theories on the internet. And don't forget, all these weird things have happened in the last 20 years, which make it more and more credible that anything could be going on, frankly.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me with all this is the idea seems to be to totally discredit the whole democratic system with someone like Biden, who's just announced this week he's not going to be standing, as we've been saying for the last probably 3 years. Finally, the mainstream press and the Democratic Party have caught up with this idea that Biden is useless. But it's almost as if that was designed to kind of take over the news agenda, to swamp the news agenda, to fill up column inches. And he's finally said no, and Kamala Harris is taking over.
Yes, but I mean, the democratic system, so-called, isn't a democratic system. It's been a rigged system for years, and it's got even more rigged in recent years. So it's not surprising that people are alienated from it because it's not running their interests. As I mentioned before, every single congressperson will be a millionaire. They will be. Most of the population are, but they are. Okay? And that's the way it runs. And money decides elections far more in the United States than it does anywhere else. Very rarely does the person who spends more money lose an election in the US. It really is about how much money you can raise. When Obama was the president, he was saying he had to spend 60% of his time as president talking to donors about the next election.
Yeah.
That's how the US system runs.
Yeah, it's pretty sick, isn't it? And also, of course, all the talk of Kamala, no mention, of course, of Robert Kennedy Jr. Dave, our sound engineer, sent me this clip from him announcing his, at least an attempt still. He's still trying to get himself up there as one of the contenders, probably not through the Democratic Party, but he's got a fantastic platform. Let's have a listen to his speech now announcing his intention to stand for president, even if he hasn't got a major party backing him.
If you look at President Biden and President Trump, you can look at them and say these are very different people. Their dispositions are different. Their personalities are different. Their expressed ideologies are very, very different. Their approach to politics could not be more distinct. But if you actually look at the policies over which they differ, over the landscapes in which they're staging this election, it's a very narrow Overton window of guns, of culture war issues, of abortion, of trans rights, etc. And the big existential issues that are actually facing our country are never addressed. The biggest of these, perhaps, is the national debt, which is now $34 trillion. The service on that debt alone is now greater than our military budget. Within 5 years, 50 cents out of every dollar that we collect in taxes will go to servicing that debt. Within 10 years, 100%. This is not sustainable. President Biden, President Trump offer no solutions. President Biden, on his web page, has no policy issues addressing this or any other policy. He has a picture of himself and saying that we're going to finish the job. But he doesn't tell what job he's going to finish. If it's the job of running up the deficit till it's completely unsustainable, that's something that the American people should know about. President Biden can't talk about it, and President Trump can't talk about it, because they're the ones chiefly responsible for running up that debt. President Trump came into office saying he was going to run the presidency as a business. He was going to balance the federal budget. And instead, he ran up an $8 trillion debt, more than all the presidents combined since George Washington. And President Biden is now on track to beat that number. So neither of them are even going to talk about this most existential issue. Another existential issue is our addiction to foreign wars. Both men have said that they're against war, and both men are feeding the war machine. The Ukraine war is a war that should have never been fought. It should have been settled. President Putin has offered twice to settle that war on terms that were enormously beneficial to the Ukrainian people and to the American people and to our security in Europe. And yet, President Putin initialed an agreement. President Zelensky initialed that same agreement in April of 2022. And President Biden sent Boris Johnson over to force Zelensky to tear up that agreement. And since then, it's probable that over 500,000 Ukrainian kids have died unnecessarily in a war that is enriching BlackRock, because they own all of the military contractors that are supplying that war. And BlackRock not only has the contract to destroy Ukraine, but it also now has the contract which President Biden gave them to rebuild Ukraine. Neither of these presidents is going to deal with the chronic disease epidemic. When my uncle was president, 6% of Americans had chronic disease. Today, 60% do. Diabetes alone, when I was a kid, the typical pediatrician would see one case of diabetes in his career, or 40 or 50 year career. Today, one out of every three children who walk through his office door is diabetic or pre-diabetic. And nobody's talking about why this is happening. The cost of dealing with mitochondrial disorders in our children, dysfunction, which is diabetes, is now greater than our military budget. The biggest cost to our nation is the cost of treating chronic disease, $4.3 trillion annually. It's five times the price of our military budget. And nobody's talking about why did autism go from 1 in 10,000 in my generation and 70-year-old men today, right now, and yet my children's generation is 1 in every 34 kids, 1 in every 22 boys. Shouldn't we be looking into this? Shouldn't we be doing the science to figure out what's causing it? We know that it's an environmental exposure or an accumulation of environmental exposures. Genes don't cause epidemics. There has to be an environmental toxin. And all the corrupt merger of state and corporate power has been overseen by both political parties. It's something neither of them, the capture of our agencies by the industries that they're supposed to regulate. They've been turned, our regulatory agencies have been turned into the sock puppets of the industries they're supposed to protect us against. And all of these are issues that are critical to the American people. And finally, the most existential issue of all, the toxic division that is destroying our country. And President Biden's the attempted assassination of President Trump this week is a symptom of that toxicity. We're now more polarized in this country than at any time since the American Civil War. And nobody can see an ending to this. If President Biden gets elected, it's going to become more toxic. If President Trump gets elected, it's going to become more polarized. And neither of these men, both of them recognize This is existential. But both of them, neither of them can do anything about it. Why? Because they feed on it. They feed it. They fuel it. And they are the products of that division.
So that's Robert Kennedy Jr., Democrat, and the nephew of Bobby, of RFK, sorry, not RFK, JFK, who was has had the back of his head blown off by James Files and the CIA and the Chicago mob back in 1963. Martin, he does present a pretty powerful Democrat platform. Why is it that the Democratic Party are not interested in this guy?
Well, he's had to run as an independent because the Democratic nomination is a stitch-up. You know, the same, you know, just like Bernie Sanders was stitched up, which is what the so-called Russiagate WikiLeaks leak was all about, was how they used the system to prevent Bernie Sanders from becoming the Democratic nominee. Now, if you're going to have two official parties, as America does, and you're going to have official, you've got to be one or the other, because you do, you have to register as a Democrat, a Republican, or an Independent, then you've got basically a system which is actually a rigged system. And it's designed to be a rigged system. Now, if you start messing around with the internal democracy within the Democratic Party, then that means that nobody can come forward within that structure. So they then have to stand as an Independent, as he now is, and all that happens under First Past the Post is that all of his votes that might have gone to Kamala Harris will go to him, which means that Trump is more likely to win with all the consequences. And it's very hard to do anything because it's like trying to walk through gloop, isn't it?
Yeah, but you said earlier on, Martin, you said earlier on that there had been an ICC arrest warrant issued for Netanyahu. Apparently, that's not the case. Legal filings from the Israeli allies have meant that there are delays in the ICC,
yes,
the International Criminal Court.
Week, as you know, to their credit, the Starmer government or regime or whatever you want to call it has lifted Britain's objection to the ICC pursuing Netanyahu and Gallant. Now, this is a potential tension between whoever wins the election in the US and the British government. The interesting developments on what's happening, and at the same time, Britain has agreed to refund the United Nations Works and whatever administration.
UNRWA, this is, yeah, the aid agency in Gaza.
We were one of the last holdouts. The US still have refusing to fund. And in any case, us deciding to fund it again is irrelevant because it's basically been smashed on the ground by the Israelis.
Anyway, it's quite interesting. It is interesting that Netanyahu had to avoid stopping in various European countries for fear of these countries executing the arrest warrant should the ICC issue one. So he's worried that he may be in France or Germany, for example, whilst this arrest warrant is issued. Over in Holland, at The Hague, at the ICC, and suddenly the police might pounce on him whilst he's in there.
That's right. But at the same time, this guy who's basically a fugitive from justice is being treated as if... I mean, he's not very popular inside Israel at all. But in the United States, because he leads the Israeli lobby, as it were, and of course he went to university in the United States, he knows everybody and all the rest of it, he's treated as if he's royalty. Nobody else gets treated like that. Can you imagine if Biden or Trump went to talk to the Congress? There'd be lots of sullen faces and people refusing to listen. When Netanyahu turns up, it's all claps and cheers.
Well, no, it wasn't, because quite a few people wouldn't attend, such as Kamala Harris.
That's right.
Didn't go.
A substantial chunk of the Democrats who didn't go, like Bernie Sanders and so on. Now, if Kamala Harris has got any sense, she could actually rally those people and say, don't vote for Trump, he wants war in the Middle East, vote for me and we'll put a stop to it. And she came out strongly saying that. She'd pick up loads of minority votes, and she'd pick loads of people, because most don't even know she is.
But whilst he's been in the United States...
She is, and we might say, oh, yeah, we like that.
Well, whilst he's been in the United States, Washington has given Netanyahu full backing, they say, to expand the war into Lebanon. Hebrew media is reporting that the army is urging Tel Aviv that now is the right time for escalation against Hezbollah And into Lebanon, former Israeli intelligence and security official Yuval Malka told Hebrew media on the 25th of July, yesterday I think that is, that Washington has greenlit a wider war on Lebanon. According to the information he received, mind you, this guy is an Israeli intelligence bloke, and what I know, Netanyahu has received full legitimacy in the United States to wage a war in Lebanon, he told Israel's Channel 14. Now, this is just talk, but do you think there's any truth to it?
Well, I mean, I've read that article that you're quoting from. We don't know for sure whether it's accurate, but I think that's probably one of the things that Netanyahu was looking for by going to the United States. We want to go to war with Lebanon. Will you back us? And the answer, of course, is yes. The question then is for Keir Starmer, are we going to get involved in this war? Because Nasrallah, who's the leader of Hezbollah, has said if Britain is involved, we are going to attack your airbase at Akrotiri in Cyprus. And we'll be looking to kill as many of your soldiers as possible, given there's all these children that are dead, because that's what wars are like. We don't want to kill children, but your soldiers, absolutely, that's a war. Let's see if Starmer's got the bottle for that, eh?
Well, we're back round to all of this, Martin. One of your favourites. I know you've got a poster of her on your wall, haven't you?
Who's this?
Whitney Webb.
Well, I haven't got a poster of her on my wall.
Haven't you? Certainly. Well, you should have. You should have. I have.
Recently, I haven't got any posters on the wall at all. Well, but yes, Whitney Webb is good, yes.
So let's have a listen to her now, talking about J.D. Vance. This is the vice presidential pick of Donald Trump. Now, we reported last week that he's invited to the Bilderberg meeting back in 2017 in Chantilly, Virginia, which is right next door to the National Security Agency and the CIA. So let's have a listen now to Whitney talking about J.D. Vance, because I don't know if you've got anything else to say about him, but the article in CBS, actually, the Big American Channel, talked about Peter Thiel, the Bilderberger, making an essay. So let's have a listen. We'll get your comments afterwards. Let's have a listen to see what Whitney's got to say about this guy, J.D. Vance. And Peter Thiel, who's the Bilderberger, he's one on the steering committee of Bilderberg. He's the founder and the beneficiary of PayPal, which is this sort of basically global money generating, was it magic money tree, I suppose, for him anyway, of the internet. And he's also funded many of these high-tech firms such as Palantir. But he's been the guy that's brought this guy, J.D. Vance, from Silicon Valley straight into Congress and then straight in to be the vice president for Donald Trump if and when he gets elected at the end of the year.
In general, politicians, when they're in office, in contrast to what they say on the campaign trail, when they're in office, they do what their donors tell them to do. So I think that's what we're likely to see in a second Trump administration, particularly with J.D. Vance as the vice president. Keep in mind, Peter Thiel was a major donor to Trump during his first campaign cycle, played an outsized role in his transition team as a result, and had major influence over people that were put in Trump's cabinet, particularly in the Pentagon, which led to an explosion of contracts between the U.S. military and Palantir during Trump's first term, as well as other, defense startups and military and intelligence contractors that are funded by Peter Thiel, which include Clearview AI, which is a facial recognition, company, and Anduril, which was created by Palmer Luckey and Trey Stevens. Trey Stevens being a big part of Thiel's founders fund, and Palmer Luckey having been a Thiel fellow that sold his VR company Oculus Rift to Facebook while Peter Thiel was on the board of Facebook. And as far as J.D. Vance is concerned, J.D. Vance not only really owes his political career to Peter Thiel, he also owes his previous venture capital career to Peter Thiel, because it started at a Thiel-linked firm called Mithril Capital. And then, after he went and joined the venture capital firm of a former or the AOL co-founder Steve Case, the Rise of the Rest Fund I mentioned earlier, and his current VC firm, Narya Capital. He co-founded with another person that he worked with at Mithril Capital and was largely funded by Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel was the main bankroller of his initial Senate campaign and subsequently was the person that brought him back into Trump's good graces after his, a lot of the quotes that have resurfaced recently about him being a never Trumper and comparing Trump to Hitler and whatnot. So a lot of, essentially the person that did more than anything else to get J.D. Vance as vice president is Peter Thiel.
So you think that J.D. Vance went from being a never Trumper calling Trump Hitler to being his vice president, to being praising Trump and being his vice president because of Peter Thiel?
Yeah, Peter Thiel personally accompanied Vance to Mar-a-Lago and brokered that. I don't know exactly what you'd call it, sort of a smoothing over of what had previously been a rocky relationship. So I think absolutely Peter Thiel has been the guiding hand of J.D. Vance's entire career. And considering that Peter Thiel, when he was a donor last time, had an outside influence on Trump's policies, at least early on, and military policies, we're likely to see it, him be even more influential in a second term, not just because of J.D. Vance, but now after J.D. Vance was announced, you have, Palantir itself and another Palantir co-founder, Joe Lonsdale, giving heavily to the Trump campaign now that Vance has been selected as a pick. So these Thiel-founded companies are since Vance was announced, have essentially signaled that they're all in on the Trump-Vance campaign. And this also includes Palmer Luckey as well of the defense contractor Anduril, which is making a lot of unmanned drones and other, defense weapons. It's building our virtual border wall on the U.S.-Mexico border that Trump supports instead of a physical barrier that he used to campaign on. And they're also hugely involved in the Ukrainian conflict.
So any sort of possibility of
a second Trump administration winding down American aid to Ukraine, I think with Thiel in the equation, becomes questionable right away because Anduril, Clearview, and Palantir itself intimately involved with the Ukrainian military as it relates to the conflict with Russia.
Well,
so anything that would see their contracts or their bottom line as it relates to their involvement in that conflict, I think it's unlikely that it would whittle down significantly if Thiel has the influence that is to be expected in a second Trump term.
So do you think that is already... So that's depressing. Thanks, but
it's the uniparty. Both sides love war, and they love surveillance. So
do you think that so Palantir, which is Thiel founded, is making big money off Ukraine?
Yeah, they're majorly involved. They're also hugely involved in Israel's war on Gaza.
Right.
Supercharging the use of AI to murder innocent people under the, a lot of these Thiel connected defense contractors claim that they're making war more efficient and sort of reducing the bloated military industrial complex. But if their idea of efficiency is AI targeting, I mean, you can see, as has been demonstrated quite clearly in Gaza, that precise AI targeting still results in the mass murder of entire families.
So do you think that? So it was surprising to me because Donald Trump seemed like he couldn't wait to become president again so he could end the Ukraine war, right? That like he knew he had like an ace up his sleeve and he knew how to do it. And the way you do it is you just threaten to, you just tell Ukraine to accept the terms of a peace agreement. And then you try to work out the best, most favorable peace agreement for Ukraine. And then you move on with your life.
Well, possible, but look at what the Ukraine started not long after, the Afghanistan war ended,
right.
National security state in the U.S. Maybe it will shut down one conflict, but it'll start another one soon after. That's why you have a CIA involvement with the beginnings of the Ukraine conflict, because they had run out of their, way to launder weapons and all sorts of money in Afghanistan. So they started Ukraine. So, if Trump is going to end the Ukraine conflict, he'd probably, start a war with Iran, which is oddly enough, something that J.D. Vance, as soon as he was named nominee, despite his Quincy Institute speech, where he claimed to be against going to war with Iran, was like, let's punch Iran hard. And he takes a lot of money from AIPAC. And if you're familiar with them, they've been, lobbying us along with the Israeli government and Israeli intelligence for war with Iran for a very, very, very long time. And as what's going on in Gaza and Israel threatens to expand into a broader regional war, some of the companies that stand to benefit most from that are connected to Peter Thiel.
Make her the director general of the BBC, somebody, please. That was the lovely Whitney Webb, the most incisive analyst, I think, with her head around everything that's going on, particularly in US politics. But Martin, she's saying some fascinating things there. This idea of Vance running as the vice president to Trump
is totally down to Thiel. I mean, this guy was saying things that he was Trump was a Nazi. Trump wanted nothing to do with him. Peter Thiel managed to bang their two heads together whilst waving $1,000 bills in front of their noses.
Well, not $1,000 bills, Tony. $1 million bills.
$1 trillion.
Yeah, I mean, this is how U.S. politics works. Yeah, this is you know, he's obviously been selected to be Trump's running mate because he's a Silicon Valley creature, and don't forget that people like Peter Thiel quite happy to fund the Democrats and the Republicans. Just depends, you know. Thiel is actually quite Republican, you know, he's libertarian.
Well, hang on. It's Eric Schmidt that funds the Democrats, and Peter Thiel funds Republicans, generally. They're both
right.
Bilderbergers. They're both Silicon Valley people.
And, of course, ultimately, they can shift their loyalty, you know.
They don't shift. No, they don't really shift.
It's decided by discussions
these billionaires. They don't really shift their party allegiance. What they do is they shift who they're funding at the time. So it might be Donald Trump. It might be J.D. Vance. It might be somebody else. But it seems to me that everything here that's going on is decided in Bilderberg Steering Committee. Well, I wanted to ask you about the Lord of the Rings. Have you noticed how all these companies that Thiel particularly is funding, the on the right of US politics and in the military, we've got so far, obviously, Palantir, which is Alex Karp runs, who's an extremely weird, spooky, another Bilderberger. That's the one which is using AI to kill people for the first time in Libya, and they believe also now they're trialing all this sort of thing in the east of Ukraine to kill Russians. They're, as Whitney explains, they're using this Palantir AI to kill Gazans. So that's one, and then that appears in The Lord of the Rings. That's this kind of spooky giant crystal ball they use for the Dark Lord Sauron can kind of meld into the minds of people far away, you know, evil, you know, and hobbits and whatever. So there's one. Then you've also got Mithril Capital, which is J.D. Vance's company. Plus, she's talking there about this massive military contractor called Anduril that is building all the drones, or many of the drones for the U.S. military. So there seems to be a bit of a theme here that somebody somewhere, I'm sure it's not my old school friend who borrowed a copy of The Lord of the Rings from me, Nick Land, somebody somewhere is obsessed by calling all these instruments of this new technological revolution, this kind of technocracy or transhumanist new world that we're moving into, where computers just take over and start killing anybody who's in the way, that they're all kind of using the Lord of the Rings, which actually is a Catholic. He was a Catholic, Tolkien. That sort of view, that they're picking these names on purpose.
Well, I'm a bit nonplussed by what you're suggesting here. I mean, the names of these companies, are they directly related to the Lord of the Rings?
Well, I don't know if you've read it, but Mithril is this elven kind of armour that they use, which is very light, like silver or something, or maybe it's aluminium, yeah. I don't know. And then Anduril is one of the swords in the Lord of the Rings. I just think it's important.
All right,
people.
So in other words, what they're doing is they're pretending to be the good guys in the Lord of the
Rings.
Aren't they?
Quite right, Martin.
They're not bad guys.
Anyway, I don't know. Have you heard enough from Whitney Webb yet, or would you like to hear a bit more?
It's up to you, Tony. It's, you know.
I know you want to hear a bit more. I mean, Jimmy Dore, who interviews her, is extremely annoying. He keeps interrupting her, just as you interrupt me and I interrupt you. But you shouldn't interrupt Whitney Webb. Let her finish her sentence, Jimmy Dore. And here we go again with, this time we're talking a little bit about Eric Schmidt's role in all this. He's another Bilderberger, of course.
When you take money from someone, it can impact what you report on. And I think some people challenge that, what you have done in this case, right? And other people do not. But I think someone like Peter Thiel is hugely influential, and I think he's not talked about enough. I mean, the billionaires like him have so much money to spend on PR and to spend on buying up influencers to try and make them look like something they're not. I mean, Peter Thiel has convinced people he's a libertarian when he's given the CIA, the national security state, the most powerful weapon in its arsenal of Palantir, not to mention some of the other companies that he's helped develop, including one that he funded alongside Jeffrey Epstein, that is taking over 911 call centers all over the country, called Carbine 911. You know, there's all this stuff happening. People need to know what Peter Thiel is actually doing, and, you know, be aware of what they're using the internet for when you interact with it, and try and take steps to mitigate it. But ultimately, I think they're trying to get us, you know, Silicon Valley runs both political parties.
That's right.
They're essentially our de facto government because yes. they've merged with the national security yes. state. All of the big tech companies are military and intelligence contractors. It's not just Palantir, but they're a big one and they put you on the naughty list, right? But, you know, essentially they all do it. And they, this is really, the people that run our government, and they're leading us into a technocratic totalitarian hellhole. And the only way to get out of it at some point is to not be dependent on their services. And they've made us dependent on their services. So I think it's high time we can still talk freely. You know, at least on some platforms, to use that to develop solutions and develop alternatives that don't involve these people, don't involve these billionaires. And it's another interesting thing too, that all of the big Silicon Valley oligarchs, every single one of them had a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Why is that? Why did Larry Page disappear when he was subpoenaed as part of the JP Morgan, Epstein USBI case? Why was Sergey Brin and Elon Musk subpoenaed? Why did Jeff Bezos and Ghislaine Maxwell have such a close relationship? Why did Reid Hoffman hang out with Jeffrey Epstein all the time? Peter Thiel had meetings with Jeffrey Epstein and co-funded companies with him. You know, so what's going on here?
So
do we want these people deciding our future and deciding who gets on the naughty list? I mean, it's just insane.
Well, what she's referring to the naughty list there is, and I'll put a full version of that interview up with bits of Jimmy Dore being irritating cut out of it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. What she's talking about, this naughty list, Martin, is basically a massive database in the States of all the people that, if there was a war, they would arrest them all because they're all subversives. Now, of course, they will have a similar sort of thing over here in the UK. It seems amazing that you've got these Bilderberg companies like Palantir. They are boasting that they can detect pre-crime and this kind of thing, people who might commit a crime, and therefore you're going to have to incarcerate them in case they get involved in civil disobedience in the future.
Well, I mean, we all know the dystopian possibilities here, but they're all coming to a head very quickly because we're on the brink of a major world war, and suddenly everything gets very, very fast, very quick, doesn't it? We'll have to see how it plays out. They're not winning. Despite it all, their plans to take over the world are not going very well.
Yeah, I mean, it seems
they're not winning the war in Ukraine, and they're not winning the war in Gaza.
No.
They think they are, but they're not.
No, they're not. And, so their chickens, it seems to me, are coming home to roost a little bit. One of the... there's a program that was made as a documentary made back in 2022 called Accelerate or Die. I was looking through the credits roll at the end of the film, which I quite often do, to see if I knew anyone who was involved in it. It's the sort of thing that guy David Rose, that Martin and I, well, you and I knew, went back in the 9/11 truth days in the noughties, probably, or was it around 2010? It's his kind of thing. It was quite a trendy film. I don't think it was up on the internet, Accelerate or Die! We just caught it this week on Sky Arts, and I recorded quite a large part of it. But let's have a listen now to that, because it talks here about accelerationism, the idea that technology is the future, and that it seems to me, and maybe before we hear the clip, you could just give us your thoughts on this, Martin, that the elite realise that the wars that they want us to fight with the enemies that they are building up, that like China and Russia and Iran and all this, that the British people and other people around Europe and the United States are simply not going to go and fight these wars because they don't believe in them. And so the idea is that society should be controlled by computers, because computers will impel people through the control of their finances and this kind of thing, and also by maybe the naughty list that we just heard Whitney Webb talking about, and obviously through drones to fight their wars for them, because people will not support them. What do you make of that?
Well, even if people did support them, which as you say, they don't, they're not trained to fight, and therefore they can't put an army together. The defeat of the US in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, you know, they haven't won anything. They didn't even win the Korean War. It was a draw. They definitely lost in Vietnam. The British Army hasn't won anything in years either. So what they, this idea that they can substitute technology for people is very attractive to them. But ultimately, of course, everything does depend on people. Technology doesn't rule everything. That's their fantasy. And, you know, the well-armed, well-trained, and now absolutely professional Russian army, they cannot do that. That's why they're going to lose, because they just can't do that. Well, it's still the important stuff.
Let's have a listen.
All this fantasy they've got that their technology will rescue them is wrong, not least because some of the technology is just not good enough. They're fighting the 1970s war with tanks and aircraft carriers. That's all over.
Maybe simply
realized that years ago.
Some of these strategists have been watching too much sci-fi and dropping too much acid.
Well, that's right. I'm reading too much Lord of the Rings, eh?
Not enough Lord of the Rings, where the good guys actually do win. You're right about that. They have absolutely right that they have pinched the good guys' names because they're afraid of what's going to happen in the future as they have their gambit to take over the world and they lose. We are hobbits, actually, on this show. We generally are. I've got hairy feet and that sort of thing. But anyway, so we're all decent people across the world. But anyway, Accelerate or Die is the documentary. Here's a clip from it now, which looks at some of the philosophy behind accelerationism and this whole concept of creating as many crises as you can and then injecting political solutions into control politics that will make things even worse.
Capitalism seems inescapable. Life without it, unimaginable. It manipulates human desire, defines how we see ourselves. We can see no exit. So perhaps we don't try to. Instead of imagining escape, perhaps we should embrace the accelerating processes that are transforming our world. This idea is called accelerationism.
I think accelerationism is the only way to respond to a disappointing present.
It's a view that says change is happening, whether we like it or not, and all we can do is decide how to relate to it, how to relate ourselves to that change. Capitalism is taking us apart and turning us into something else, and all you can do is embrace it.
You know, there's a certain inevitability. There's no rolling back any of the ways in which technology and capitalism have disrupted our understanding of ourselves and our understanding of our world. We can't pretend that we're going to somehow return to a idyllic rural existence where we all are friends with the squirrels and the birds. So accelerationism is really a stance or an attitude toward the future that rather than being defensive, is affirmative about that disassembly of what it is to be human and what human desire is.
And I think that there's something really humble about being able to situate oneself in a world where human agency and even humanness is no longer something that can be taken for granted.
Accelerationism accepts that, for better or for worse, the capitalist machine is remaking the world, and humanity is the fuel. Whether we like it or not, the process is accelerating. Rather than resist, all we can do is take our foot off the brake and hold on tight. Decades before anyone used the word accelerationism, many of its ideas were emerging from a group of academics called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, or CCRU. At its center was Nick Land, a now widely criticized philosopher whose recent work has strayed far from the accelerationist mainstream.
What was the CCRU?
The CCRU didn't exist. It was never part of any institution, never had any official status. It was just a group of people who came together with an interest from various perspectives in understanding the relation between a rapidly changing technological environment and human culture.
Nick Land was a professional philosopher a long time ago in the 90s at the University of Warwick, and he became, along with a sort of group of other philosophical misfits called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, very interested in the development of culture at the end of the 20th century, coming out of the sort of acceleration of capitalism and what it was doing to the way in which people were living and what they wanted.
But at the time, it was quite anticipative of things that hadn't quite happened yet. The inhuman element of capitalism was taken by CCIU and is taken by accelerationism as a kind of bracing alternative to the existing model of what it means to exist and to be human. Anything that negates capitalism can be consumed and digested by it. Like, in a sense, an allegory, being like Terminator is like this liquid metal thing that can change into any shape and never stops and can never be defeated. The only thing we can do is participate enthusiastically rather than retreat defensively.
Embrace it. All you can do is kind of dissolve yourself into the floor, buckle in and enjoy the ride.
So that's a clip from Accelerate or Die. I'll put a link up to the actual documentary. Well worth watching. If you've got a big screen on your, you know, on your TV, on your wall, on your smart TV or whatever, then or whatever you've got, if it's a big, it's well worth watching. It's very interesting visually. But what it's doing is it's making out that Marxism and socialism never existed. Capitalism is the only way. It's saying all you can do is just buckle in and enjoy the ride as humanity goes down the toilet.
Well, in actual fact, nothing they are saying is inconsistent with the original vision of Marx and Engels. They were the first ones to really notice how revolutionary capitalism was. All that is solid melts into air. So all traditional relationships are reduced to the cash nexus. It's a revolutionary system that's, you know, but in the process, it educates people. I was reading an article by Lucas Leroz on strategic culture today, and he's pointing out maybe two-thirds, maybe more than that, three-quarters of the world's population have access to the internet at least once a day. Now, that is one of the things that capitalism has made, but it means that everybody can recirculate pictures of Gazan babies being blown up. And in actual fact, that works against their goals, because human beings are still human beings, and they react to that.
I was looking at the credits on that documentary. Unbelievable amount of money went into it. It's about an hour and a half long altogether. There was something like 45, 50 people on the credits, all sorts of, like, it must have been a fortune spent on it. One of the people on the credits was George Monbiot, who they've used and paid for some of his artwork, apparently, to be used on the program, although he's not interviewed.
The film. It may be a critical analysis of the whole question of acceleration.
Well, no, it's not. No, because this is... All I'm saying, Martin, is no, it's not. It's definitely not. It's almost like selling it as an inevitability, which, of course, is part of the acceleration's tactic.
Noel Harari...
Yeah.
Harari pushes exactly this stuff.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that it's very similar to the sort of scientific exaggeration in the 19th century.
Yeah, you're right. That's quite right. It's almost like they're trying to sell, Martin, they're trying to sell...
And they were all going to have to do what they wanted them to do, and that was all.
They're trying to sell the technocracy as an inevitability, which, of course, it's not, because it's not working. It's going to break. So they don't have anything.
It's vulnerable to breakdown, and in any case, by circulating,
it broke down last week.
People lower down the hierarchy, they learn how to use it as well.
It all broke down.
Which is the whole revolutionary purpose of capitalism, according to the original Marxist conception.
It all broke down.
Everybody learns how to use this technology, and then we can use it against them.
It all broke down last week, Martin.
It might have broken down by accident, or it might have broken down on purpose.
Well, yes, and maybe it will be cyber attacked, and it won't work. So anyway, the idea that everybody can just sort of
old-fashioned arson attacks on the French railway system yesterday.
This morning,
saboteurs burning cables and wrecking it. Nothing cyber about it. Don't know who did it this morning. But they did.
Well, it's probably Extinction Rebellion, that one, isn't it?
I'm not quite sure.
Something along those lines from France, anyway. But anyway, it may just be. But anyway, the other thing is not mentioned. The other thing that's not mentioned in this documentary, called Accelerate or Die, it are links to the Nazis and Nick's satanic philosophy. Nothing either to do with LSD and hallucinogenic drugs, which these people are into.
It's about the idea of a super elite who are super aware, have esoteric knowledge, Tony. Mm. Yeah? They're not just like you and me. They've got esoteric knowledge.
That's why they're entitled to rule.
Isn't it interesting?
I mean, you did philosophy. Why is it that philosophers, particularly Nietzschean philosophers, seem to think that they have the right to control the world? I mean, they have this...
to be honest with you, as a philosopher, but brought up in the English tradition, I would regard Nietzsche as an artist rather than a philosopher. I'll be honest with you. Interesting books to read, but at the end of the day, it's not like reading Plato or Aristotle where there is actually an argument. And you've got to make an... It's poetry. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is a big, long rant. You know, it's like a huge version of the Book of Revelation. Worth reading if you're interested in expanding your mind.
I would say much more... You're just poking at me there by comparing it to the Book of Revelation. It's more like something like James Joyce, isn't it?
Yes. It's art, and art has its own justification. But is it philosophy? I studied philosophy in England, I'm part of the empiricist tradition. People like E.P. Thompson were Marxists, but he famously wrote a book, The Poverty of Theory, about all of the clever ideas that were coming out of the French Academy in the eras when he was. It's all very interesting, this stuff. But basically, it's a lot of verbiage.
If you can't explain
what you mean in straightforward language, it probably ain't.
Isn't it rather like Ayn Rand? Martin, we've got to wind up, please.
We've got to be very careful with it.
Martin, isn't it a bit like Ayn Rand?
Well, Ayn Rand is just a joke. I mean, Ayn Rand was basically a potboiler novelist who thought that she'd invented objectivism, the very first person ever, and which basically meant just being selfish. And she thought that her great discovery upended the whole of the philosophical tradition. And, of course, it didn't. And she was influenced by Nietzsche, you're right, but she didn't want to say so, because as far as she's concerned, she's the first one to think of any of it.
Anyway,
there's no reference in any of her works to Aristotle, Plato, or any of the or Kant, or any of the Marx, any of the philosophers of the tradition. Because, in actual fact, she said, I don't have to read all that. That's a load of nonsense. I am Ayn Rand, and I know more than everybody that's ever gone before me, and what we've got to do is just be selfish. Adam Smith, who was also a philosopher, yeah? I mean, the Wealth of Nations was part of the whole treatise on philosophy. He said, well, selfishness is not the, you know, people are naturally selfish, but they're not just naturally selfish. They've got all sorts of other parts of their character as well. Why can't we just be selfish?
Well, can you please just keep the verbiage down a little bit? Yeah, short points, because we're right at the end of the program. Aren't there sort of three types of people really out there? You've got actually genuinely, I mean, you maybe don't believe in this, but genuinely public-spirited people who think of others before themselves. Then you've also got selfish people. But then you've got also quite a large number of people who are selfish, but they like to pretend that they're public-spirited.
Well, I mean, that's what human life has always been about. I mean, the problem with the Ayn Rand philosophy and the accelerationism is they're coming straight out with it and saying, we're better than you and we demand to rule because we're better than you. Now, if you want to rule people, that's not really very good, you know, they're not going to accept that necessarily.
Well, maybe they're
not. It's better to say, no, I'm Mao Zedong and I'm going to liberate you. Follow my movement and we will make you free. That might be a lie, but it's more convincing.
One place,
lie. Follow me, and I'm going to tell you what to do, and it's in my interest, and you just do as you're told.
Yeah, well, that's all funded by Yale in China, back in the 1920s, the bookshops of Mao. But anyway,
yes, I know, but it wasn't just him. It wasn't him that would have been a revolution there anyway. Tony,
maybe. Bangladesh this week has been completely out of the internet. No emails. The government has completely shut the internet down. So anybody looking at Bangladesh will be seeing a big black nothing. And also, obviously, people in there. But so I had to go scry around a bit, and I found an Al Jazeera report this week on what's actually been going on, because there's been very little news in the UK here about what's actually happening. We're not allowed to know, apparently.
And we'll now speak to Irene Khan, who's the UN Special Rapporteur on the freedom of opinion and expression. She's joining us from Geneva. Welcome to Al Jazeera, ma'am. First, I'd like you to comment on what the Minister of Information and Broadcasting of Bangladesh had to say when he said it's not the government that is responsible for the violence. It's, in fact, third-party actors.
Well, it sounds to me like disinformation rather than information. Of course the government is responsible for security, and the government has been handling this very badly. There has been a violent crackdown with police and military on the ground. Government ministers had made inflammatory statements while peaceful protests were going on, asking government-affiliated groups to attack the students, which then happened. So it's a very bloody, horrible mess now, and the government has to restore security, but they have to restore it, keeping in mind the human rights of the people involved. That's what we are asking for in our press release. Yeah. We are also asking...
Yeah, here it is. Yeah. I have your press release right in front of me, and you've added your name along with a number of experts. As you just said, you're calling for an immediate end to the violent crackdown, as you describe it, and full accountability for human rights violations. On that issue of accountability, how do you see that happening? What are you calling for? What are the steps that need to be taken?
Well, given all the broken promises that this government has made on human rights, the false assurances that have been given, and the wrong information that is being floated now, there is no trust in the government. People don't trust it. It's very obvious. And we are calling for an independent, impartial, thorough investigation into what has happened. The government is blaming other people. Others are blaming the government. We need a full, impartial investigation. But since there is no trust in the government, it has to be done with the international community. We are calling on the government to invite the UN to conduct such an investigation, to find out what went wrong, to take responsibility, and to hold the perpetrators to account.
And just on that call, have you received a response from the Bangladeshi government yet?
No, we have provided this statement to them as well. And this morning, the High Commissioner for Human Rights himself has also put out a press release where he too is offering his services, the UN services, and we are waiting for an answer from the government.
From what you've seen, ma'am, if you can just put this into context for us and tell us, in your opinion, to what extent has there been a decline or not of human rights in Bangladesh recently?
Well, there's been a disastrous decline. This is not something that just suddenly popped up. For years, institutions are being undermined. There have been other clashes in the past. We've seen an election that a lot of people have called was rigged. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction, discontent on the ground with corruption, mismanagement, with the police and law enforcement, for example, regular stories of torture. Even now, we are hearing stories from people about journalists being threatened for reporting, about students disappearing, about people turning up and just picking up whoever they suspect and taking them away, torturing them, leaving them out. Sometimes they're disappearing. That means they're killed. So in this kind of lawless situation, you know, this has the country cannot continue.
Right.
Bangladesh was described as a development miracle. Where has that miracle gone? It's gone down this drain of human rights disasters. And Now we are asking the government, one way forward is through this impartial, independent, thorough investigation with the help of the United Nations or the international community.
Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the freedom of opinion and expression, thank you for speaking to us from Geneva.
So there's some insight there into what's been going on in Bangladesh, which is this quota system. The government has got a kind of list of its favoured citizens, which it then gives jobs to and not to others. And that's what many of these protests have been about, Martin, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the Awami League were the leaders of the armed revolt against Pakistani rule in the 1970s. Pakistani army came in and killed loads and loads and loads of people. Massacres. Horrendous. And eventually there was an armed resistance. And eventually the Indian army invaded Bangladesh, just like the Vietnamese army invaded Cambodia, and, you know, drove the Pakistanis out and then withdrew, handed over power to the Awami League. And Sheikh Hasina, of course, is the, I think she's the daughter of one of the leaders of the Awami League. And what she's done is said what they said they were going to do was 30% or something like that of all jobs in the government and so on, places in university, were going to go to the relatives of people who died during that era, that is to say, Awami League supporters. Now, of course, a Bangladesh National Party, I believe, is the right-wing opposition to the Awami League. They're not happy with that because they want, you know, their people won't get places in university, places in the civil service. So that then led them to revolt. The police then put it all down, and it's all a bit of a mess. And of course, it's a very poor country anyway. Loads of international debt, so there's no real room for manoeuvre. You know, as we know, we hear about Bangladesh when garment factories burned down and everybody's incinerated. There's quite a lot of Bangladeshi community in Britain, of course, and at one stage Keir Starmer was going about, we've got to send people back to Bangladesh who are not supposed to be here. And the Bangladeshi community leaders were saying, well, why Bangladesh? It's just the word that came into my mind, you know, Bangladesh, why not? But in actual fact, there are very few asylum seekers from Bangladesh, although possibly with what's happening now, there may be a few more, you know, because of, you know, the people have, you know, now fallen foul of the authorities and so on. It's a messy situation.
I mean, do you think is this a sort of tug of war here going on? I mean, we've seen many countries, haven't we, that are following the Western model and have orange revolutions and this sort of thing going on, where the political leaders are basically put there by the United States and their allies, having all sorts of trouble. And this could simply be part of the Western sphere of influence, which the West is now starting to lose control of Bangladesh.
Well, I don't know enough about the detail of the particular situation, but a similar situation has happened in Kenya, where the government of the day... But don't forget, there are elections in Kenya and there are elections in Bangladesh. So the elected government does have a case to say, look, we're the elected government. Yeah? Same in Georgia, where there's been protests against it's not pro-Russian, it's just not pro-Western.
Well, there's
government.
Definitely a tug-of-war going on in Georgia.
In Bangladesh, but it may be... Like a lot of other places, these are grievances which are not necessarily related to wider stuff in the outside world.
Well, I wonder.
Way or the other.
I mean, you went to Oxford University, didn't you? You know where I'm going with this question?
To Oxford University?
You went to Oxford University. Well, the Chancellor of Oxford University is up for grabs. Imran Khan from jail is going to compete with Tony Blair and Boris Johnson to be Oxford Chancellor. Who do you think stands the best chance?
Well, I would vote for Imran Khan. Then I'm not a fellow, so I don't decide things like that. You see, one of the things Oxford University did in the 1980s, they wouldn't give Margaret Thatcher an honorary degree, even though she was a graduate of the university. Because that was, you know, the view was that she was wrecking the country and we're not going to reward her. It may well be that Oxford University, in its wisdom, will decide to give it to Imran Khan rather than Tony Blair.
Well, let's hope so. Or Boris. Both of them,
I mean,
warmongers.
Much more deserving. Let's put it that way.
Okay, thanks, Martin. And we're going to wind up now with Gary Waterman, who's talking a little bit about the background to everything that's going on, which is the focus. Maybe Martin, you could just comment on this little thought of mine, that the reason that the Gaza war is carrying on is because obviously it has to stop for Netanyahu's point of view. Surely it's got to slow down, it's got to stop, because You know, the pressure is even coming from the Israeli Defense Force to stop the slaughter in Gaza, but yet he wants to carry it on. And it, maybe he'll try and carry it on until there's an election in the United States, and maybe if Donald Trump gets in, he wants Donald Trump not to start a war, but to inherit the war rather than to start another war. What do you make of that thought?
Well, I mean, all of these things, the ball is in play, and we don't know what's going to happen, but the room for miscalculation, as in 1914, is very, very high. Very high. This is the most dangerous position we've been in for many, many years, and more dangerous than 1914 because of all the nuclear weapons, eh?
Okay, Martin, thanks for joining us. We're finished with Gary Waterman tonight.
26th of June 2024, I'm Gary Waterman, a former police constable in the UK and a Christian and a victim of this international government fraud. We're going to talk about this document, which is in relation to a letter, a supposed letter by Albert Pike to Mazzini. Now, I was sent this a little while ago by somebody that I'm working with, but somebody else has also mentioned it. And I haven't verified or corroborated any of the information in this document, but I think it is becoming more and more relevant to everything that's going on at the moment, so I'm going to read it and just talk about some of the bits through this document as well. And it says, the Illuminati plan for three world wars, August 15th, 1871. The first thing to think for me to mention in relation to that is that Company's House was started in 1844, not long before this. And Company's House is very clearly the vessel for international fraud linked to child trafficking and many of the world's problems that we are now seeing going on. I'll read on. The following is a letter that speculation claimed that Albert Pike wrote to Mazzini in 1871 regarding a conspiracy involving three world wars that were planned in an attempt to take over the world. Now, everything that I've seen and the evidence that I've presented suggests it's very clearly what they're doing is a plan to control everybody completely. Okay, it all appears to be a progressive move to full digital control, including digital currency and the removal of the ability for people to withhold their payments if they want to for any in relation to any criminal government, and have the risk of their finances being frozen for doing so. That means the people are going to be forced to either pay towards a criminal process or risk not being able to survive. And everything appears to be setting up and towards that full control of the world. Reading on, the Pike letter to Mazzini was on display in the British Museum Library in London in 1977. That's the year I was born. This letter has been claimed by many internet sites to reside in the British Library in London, which denies the letter exists. Mazzini is an Italian revolutionary leader of the mid-1800s, as well as the director of the Illuminati. Now, this is quite important because there are Italian connections. You'll see from my latest Hampstead Child Abuse Inquiry, there are Italian directors that link to Italian companies. We've also got other research of mine that links to the Italian Chamber of Commerce, that links to the Portuguese Chamber of Commerce. And, of course, this is where Madeleine McCann disappeared, and there's evidence around the fraud there. But also, I haven't specifically got the evidence, but many people are saying that the Vatican is key to a lot of this. Now, I know full well there's many church networks that have been set up as fraudulent entity companies, illegal entity companies, part of this fraudulent system. And we all know that throughout society, and obviously it's highlighted within the churches, that there has been child abuse cases. Now, the notorious address of Finchley Road, 788 790 Finchley Road, which was featured in the Ham and High article from 2019, even mentions connections to mafia, to dictators, to corrupt politicians, to international government fraud, and to defrauding the general public from the taxation system. And it even mentions specific directors, such as Barbara Cahan, within companies, and companies such as A1 Company Services, which features throughout my research. Now, reading on, Albert Pike, in brackets, historical Masonic figure, was a 33rd degree Freemason, occultist, Grand Master and creator of the southern jurisdiction of the Masonic Scottish Rite Order. Now, you can see through my research that there is clear connections to the Freemasonic Network, Freemasonic Society, through this link to the fraud and to the child trafficking. Now, it mentions the Scottish Rite Order here. There's specific people at the moment that are heavily involved in government, the likes of Douglas Dougie Smith, who is Rishi Sunak's special advisor at the moment. He's been the special advisor for the last few prime ministers. According to research, he started up fever sex parties. He's been arrested for threats to kill. Nadine Dorries, who worked within government or with government, has said that he practices the dark arts. He's Scottish. Research shows that he was involved in the management of security for oil fields in the Middle East and COVID sites, and also airport, at least one airport in the Middle East area. Now, the Scottish connections are rather huge in relation to this. You have Scottish companies, the PPE scandal with Michelle Moan, who is Scottish, I believe, and links to the fraudulent entity and apparent corruption through government. And Michelle Moan links to Scottish companies as well, which links to the royal family. There's lots of royal family connections through to all of this. And you'll see from my evidence from Rishi Sunak that it links to the royal family quite significantly around the Russian intelligence agencies and the Russian English Chamber of Commerce, fraud throughout, linking to child trafficking through monks off the islands of Wales. And I do suggest, it's, you know, you go and look at this document, the Rishi Sunak document and videos that I've produced, and also through to directed energy weapons companies. So there is this huge connection through Scotland and Freemasons. Reading on. The following are apparently extracts from the letter showing how three world wars have been planned for many generations. The First World War must be brought about in order to permit the Illuminati to overthrow the power of the Tsars in Russia and of making the country a fortress of atheistic communism. The divergences caused by the agenteur, in brackets, agents of the Illuminati between the British and Germanic empires will be used to foment this war. At the end of the war, communism will be built and used in order to destroy the other governments and in order to weaken the religions.
So that's Gary Waterman there. Former cop who seems to have just come across this Albert Pike thing. Obviously, what people have for many, many years. I remember looking up at one point, someone was saying, oh, it all goes back to this one book that was published by William Guy Carr, former Canadian naval officer, back in, I think it was in the 1960s or 70s or 50s maybe even. But it doesn't. It's lots and lots of references to it throughout history, obviously, throughout the late 1800s and early 1900s. And it seems to explain what's going on, and particularly interesting hearing Martin's point earlier about the attempt to use the emblems, if you want, the symbols of the jargon of the Lord of the Rings, of the good guys, to represent themselves. Because this is exactly what we hear from people like David Livingstone describing the Book of Revelation and the Gnostics, the way that the accelerationists, the Gnostics, the transhumanists want to be the good guys in Revelation, but actually they're the bad guys. So this twisting of future prophecy and biblical prophecy into something which where you are the bad guys, but you're trying to pretend that you're the good guys, seems to be largely what is going on in the world today. So anyway, thank you very much for Gary Waterman for that. I'll put a link up to the full interview with him and to his channel on the show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, that is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to Dr. Judith Brown at the Control of Information blog and Substack, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And you can follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can also donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. Actually, no, it's not anymore, is it? It's the talkradio.org.uk stream. And over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make live recordings, feel free. And talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. We've been streaming live from the East Stone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, Soapbox, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you make mistakes, as we all do, please admit them to those involved and to yourself. But do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters and accelerationists get you down.
blood and money. It's blood and money. It may look good from a distance, but up close it smells like death. Yet you offer no resistance, knowing not a word is said. But let me ask you this one question, and surely even you'll agree. Who could consider it good fortune to be paid in blood money? Sun City, no fun city. Sun City, Sin City. But tell me, how can this be so? When you really plan to cash in on the misfortunes of the poor. They don't have no good conditions, they don't make no decent pay. If they speak a word of protest, they'll quickly whisked away. If they dare to gather in the streets to have their grievance heard. Machine guns blare, hundreds die, no one says a word. If you're not with us, you're against us, and that's all that I can see. If you offer no resistance and take pay in blood money. Sun City, no fun city. Sun City, Sin City.
Tonight was clear and the wind was soft as they walked side by side. He said, "Who's that guy following us about?" She said, "He's just a friend of mine.
Just a friend."
Rough enough to keep her satisfied. She said, "Hold it, baby, it gets too much. I feel like I'm gonna die." He took her home in the early morning. She said, "Please do come inside." He said, "Who's that guy in a dressing gown?" She said, "He's just a friend of mine. He's just a friend of mine.